Welcome, brothers, sisters, fellow working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Robert Applebaum, attorney from Staten Island and the founder of ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com. Going to be here talking about the student debt problem that's going to almost, $1 trillion right now. $1 trillion. Students owned to big banks. $1 trillion hanging over the heads of the college students who graduated, not graduated, going through the process. $1 trillion. You want to talk about a big bubble? You want to talk about something that might get the economy going? Well, we'll talk to Robert Applebaum about the possibility of forgiving the student loan debt, which is something that the folks in all of the occupations across the country are calling for because, hey, look, they were promised you go through you get a good education, you show the employer that you've done 4 more years of work for the privilege of working for them, and there will be something at the end. Well, you know what? These kids are realizing they threw a ton of money into this, and there's nothing at the end of the rainbow. Now, there's a whole movement of people saying, well, you know, I did it, and I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. You should have to suffer, too. Nonsense. Also, Mark Anderson from Daily Kos Labor is going to be here talking about the Scott Walker recall, which is about ready to ramp up, and also the job losses in the state of Wisconsin, which have really happened because of Walker and the policies that he has put forth. And also our good friend Lee Fong from Think Progress will be here in the third hour talking about the Occupation Nation and some of the bizarre things going on around that with the radical right wing. You know, it's amazing, just amazing how the radical righties have, well, conveniently done some very bizarre things that, you know what, I don't ever remember lefties doing to them during their whole little Tea Party thing. I don't remember anyone posing as a Tea Partier to try and make the Tea Party people look bad. That's a righty trick. That's a wealth class trick. That's something the Koch brothers would endorse. Hey, let's send in some troublemakers. And that's what they do. So today, as I understand, day 25 of the occupation of Wall Street, and the mainstream corporate-controlled media, they're still searching for definitions. They're still trying to figure out how they can pigeonhole this whole thing, how they can narrowly frame it. And then the whole time they're doing this, it's mockery. And quite evident that they're trying to make a mockery out of what these folks are trying to do. And it's really bizarre what they're doing. On one hand, you know, they're trying to say, well, these kids, they don't know why they're out there. They don't have a clue. Yet on the other hand, they say, no, wait, they're radical. They're radicals and they hate America. They want to bring down our way of government. They hate us. They hate the American way of life. They want to destroy capitalism. They want to destroy our entire way of life. Don't trust them. One hand, they have no idea. They're clueless. They're just walking in the park. They don't know what they're doing. But on the other hand, and it's kind of funny to watch them go back and forth between the, well, they don't know what they're doing and, oh, they're bringing us down. And, you know, another frame that they're trying to grapple with, one is, they're just a bunch of bums. They don't have jobs. They're lazy. They don't want jobs. We'd offer them jobs, but they wouldn't take it. The banks came out and, you know, offered them a job to work as a teller, and the girl wouldn't take it. They're just lazy. They don't want to work. Out of the other side of their mouth, they're just a bunch of spoiled rich kids. They're just a bunch of rich college kids. They get to go to those New York colleges where, you know, their parents have to work on Wall Street. The other part of it is, don't take them serious. Don't worry. And out of the other side of their mouth, take them very seriously. I heard Glenn Beck say this today, and I haven't been able to stop laughing all day long. They're violent hippies. Now, those are two words that I don't put together. Violence and violent hippies? Really? That sounds like a satirical punk band. The Violent Hippies. Really? Violent hippies? Show me that. I would love to see violent hippies. You want a definition, righties? You want the definition of what's going on here? These are people who are trying to find their voice. They're trying to find a way to express their anger, their frustration, and take an active role in what this country is going to look like. And this really scares the talking heads. This scares the corporate elites. This scares the billionaire class. Because when they can't define it, and when they can't define it, that scares them because they can't minimalize it. They can't mock it. They can't ridicule it because there's really no definition yet. And look, I don't know what's going to happen with this. I'm not claiming to be the expert. What I'm telling you is that what I'm hearing in the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media is not the reality of what's going on. They're going looking for one or two fringe characters. And like I talked about last night, you know, the righties in Philadelphia, on the way back, all they talked about was the one guy. Out of like 3,000 or 4,000 people, there was one guy that they focused the entire hour I listened on. And look, I got to be honest, I laughed at the guy too. But at the end of the day, that is not what defined the entire group. One guy, one transgender guy walking around saying, I was fired because I'm transgender. That was not the movement. Now, seeing a guy, you know, big hairy guy, you know, in a dress with hair sticking out of his stockings and a mustache and beard, as I've seen in the past, that makes me laugh. And we should all get a good chuckle out of that. But that's not the movement. The movement here is holding banks accountable. The movement here is government that works. I think everybody there wants what we've been talking about on this program for years. An economy that works for everyone so that we can achieve the American dream. We can have that little white house with a picket fence. We can have our 2.3 kids in a safe neighborhood with good schools. We can have opportunity to have a decent job that will allow us to take a vacation every now and again, send our kids to college, do the things that our grandparents and our parents were able to do. Retire with a little dignity, a little security, and not have to worry that in your final days you're going to die in destitution. I think that's kind of... it's broad, but it is kind of the discussions that have been going on. So as this thing takes off, and as we see more people being involved, we'll see more and more of these fringe elements, but also more and more of the conversation, which, again, is what the wealth class is afraid of. They're afraid that we're going to finally figure out the trick. The trick being, oh, well, you know, the whole trickle-down thing hasn't worked. The smart people at the top who we were told that if we just give them the money because they know what to do with it, everything would be fine. Well, you know what? We gave them all the money that they could possibly want and even more. And they have not done what they claimed they were going to be able to do. Look, we've got over 9% unemployment, and a good majority of the folks who are working, well, they're not making a whole ton of money either. What we need a tax code that works. That it funds our government, that distributes wealth in a way that is smart, which means, you know what, sorry, folks at the top, you need to pay a little bit more. And according to a new Bloomberg Washington Post poll, more than two-thirds of people polled, including 53% of Republicans, believe that the folks at the top of the economic ladder should pay a little bit more. You know, help pay down the deficit, help pay for the things we need, you know, all that military spending we've been hooked on, all of the spending that we need to run things. Maybe, just maybe. Maybe we should be funding the things that we've needed for years. And leave Medicare and Social Security alone, which even more than two-thirds say leave it alone. Maybe that's a place to start. And I look at Bruce Bartlett, who was a former Reagan official. Who has written extensively on this. He points out that there have been more than 20 polls recently showing that average, everyday working people and people across the spectrum, they favor raising taxes on the people who have the money. Even when the righties keep saying, no, the American people don't want to raise taxes. We're teed out. We're taxed enough already. Nonsense. I think when you start talking about targeted tax increases, you start talking about how we're going to pay for things, I think if you have that adult, honest conversation with people, they get it. Yeah, the money's all at the top. We should maybe ask for a little bit. And the right-wing spin machine has been in full spin. This whole talk machine, the spin cycle is working overtime. And I got to be honest, I am so tired of hearing the right-wing blathering on and on about, oh, half the country doesn't pay taxes. They don't pay anything. When the reality is, and we know that more than 80% of people who file income tax, they pay some type of federal tax, be it Social Security, be it Medicare, whatever, they pay something. So this idea that, well, you know, half the country pays nothing, nonsense. And everybody pays sales tax, everybody pays state tax, everybody pays local taxes, gas tax, property tax, you name it, people are paying that. So this idea, well, half the country pays nothing and they're living off of me, nonsense. But like most frames that aren't true, the right never wants to let go of it, even if it is dead flat wrong. And this half the people pay nothing, is that dead flat wrong? But if we're going to use the righty argument that half the country doesn't pay any federal tax, I think looking at the analysis by the people over at the Detroit Free Press, I think looking at what they did recently kind of turns that argument just a little bit. They said in 2009, more than 20,000 tax filers making more than $200,000 a year paid zero federal tax. I don't hear a grand cry by the righties saying, you know, make those people making $200,000 a year or more, make them pay. I don't hear that. They want that minimum wage guy. They want the guy giving you your food out the window at McDonald's to pay a higher tax rate. But not the guy making over 200 grand. And in fact, over 1,400, almost 1,500 people with incomes over $1 million paid no federal income tax. Nothing. But I don't hear the righties going on about that. I don't hear the Cantors or the Boehners or the Ryans. I don't hear any of them going on about all those millionaires. They didn't pay a dime. Not a bit at all. You look at USA Today. They reported that people making $75,000 to $100,000, they too are walking away unscathed. So, you know, we talked about this last night a little bit. It's nice to have those incentives. It's nice to have that stuff around. It's nice to give people incentives to put money in certain places when you have a high enough tax rate. But when you have people making $1 million a year paying nothing, I got a problem with that. And USA Today reports that they still make up less than 1% of the total number of income filers who pay no tax at all, but their overall numbers have exploded. Now, back in 1996, they said that there are fewer than 5,000 people who paid no taxes. This is 96. Fewer than 5,000. You jump to 2009, which was the last year they had data for. 500,000 people paid no tax at the top. That, to me, my friends, quite amazing. Quite amazing indeed. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Robert Applebaum, attorney and founder of ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Back after this.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American standard of living is in decline as household income for working families continues to fall. According to the Census Bureau, inflation-adjusted median household income fell 9.8% from the start of the Bush Great Recession through June of 2011. The report on household income by Census Bureau officials Gordon W. Green Jr. and John F. Coder said this household income decline is a significant reduction in the American standard of living. So our economic system not only is failing to create nearly enough jobs for us, those of us who still have jobs are watching our income go down in what is supposed to be an economic recovery. salary. Princeton economic professor Henry S. Farber also found that workers who found work again after losing their jobs made an average of 17.5% less in their new jobs. As the United Auto Workers Union worked Monday to reach a deal with Chrysler on a new four-year labor contract, UAW leaders called local bargaining units to a Detroit meeting. Chrysler is complaining that the GM and Ford deals are too rich, despite the fact that those deals increased labor costs by just 1% at GM and Ford. Both the UAW and Chrysler say they want to reach a negotiated deal and not go to arbitration. Arbitration must take into consideration the compensation for workers at foreign plants operating in the U.S. UAW total compensation is still higher than those plants. The contract for 23,000 UAW workers at Chrysler expired September 14th. Honeywell workers in Kansas City are on strike. Jesse Russell has more.
2 months ago, United Steelworkers ratified a three-year contract agreement with Honeywell International's uranium processing facility in Metropolis. That agreement ended a 13-month-long lockout of workers at the plant. Honeywell is now facing a strike at a Kansas City plant, with workers putting down their tools on Sunday. The most recent contract offer was rejected by 79% of voting employees, and 85% voted to strike. The employees are represented by the International Association of Machinists, who issued a statement saying the company is negotiating in bad faith over a three-year contract. The machinists plan to file unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board. The union has declined to reveal the allegations due to the NLRB being closed Monday for a federal holiday.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I gotta listen to man. He was written on the palm of my hands. I'm almost missing you on the right hand. Feeling an end of thought. You wanna see somebody. See somebody. Try to free somebody. Gotta listen to man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, question, comment, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails. Personally, also, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website there. You know, this whole thing going on in D.C. and across the country, the occupations, kind of some interesting tweets that I've come across. One of them came out of this guy, Nathan Wurzel. He is a conservative fundraiser, consultant, and, of course, principal at the consultant group that bears his name. He's kind of upset about the protesters in the streets, and he tweeted that his plan to clear K Street of all the protesters was to, you know, hit them with the car. Get a couple of them with the car, take them out. Maybe that would be a good start, according to him. Interesting. But these people are in the streets for a reason. They're angry, they're frustrated, and a lot of the folks that I talk to, it comes down to the student loan problem. The fact that we told these kids, you know what, you go to college, get a good education, take on good debt, invest in yourself, and you'll have a future. Thousands of people I saw, they did that, and they're now living the American nightmare. So I've asked Robert Applebaum. He's an attorney from Staten Island, New York, and he's also the founder of ForgiveStudentLoan.com. ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Robert's name. Robert Applebaum, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at what's going on across the country at all of these protests, and a lot of it boils down to these kids are frustrated that there are no jobs, and they are saddled with massive debt. I think the last number I saw was somewhere close to $1 trillion in student loan debt in this country.
That's true. Actually, right now it's about $947 billion and growing exponentially by the day, and it is on track to exceed $1 trillion within the year, which is really just an amazing number.
Well, I mean, what it is a massive shift from taxpayers paying colleges and investing in education for students of the future and shifting it from the taxpayer to the individual who is now, right during this recession, during this economic downturn, saddled with this massive debt with nowhere to get out from under it.
That's exactly right. I've been talking about this issue for 2.5 years, and one of the biggest gripes I have about the educational system is that we've turned education into a commodity. No longer is going to college about educating students. It's a big business. And for 30 or 40 years ago, we used to fund education through scholarships and grants, and tuition was low, and people, if they had to make up the difference, did so with student loans that they could manage after they graduated. Today, the exact opposite is true. Student loans are the first thing that people have to go and apply for to fund their educations. And oftentimes, because of the skyrocketing tuition, federal loans, which are obviously better than private loans for a number of reasons, but not so great in and of themselves, they often have to avail themselves of private loans to make up the difference. So, in effect, we've shifted the burdens not only of obtaining an education, but of maintaining this huge educational system down the socioeconomic ladder onto those who can least afford to shoulder them.
Especially when you look at the fact that, you know, we've now got a for-profit higher education system who preys on the lower income, because, boy, they can get an awful lot of money from the federal government.
Not only that, but they misrepresent what they can do. The for-profit industry actually misrepresents job placement opportunities, the number of graduates, how many students they have who are defaulting, and that's why you've seen the Obama administration take some measures to combat for-profit educational system, but nowhere near enough.
You know, you talked about the federal loans and private loans, and I think there's an education process that has to be there as well. What's the difference between a federal loan, you know, a loan guaranteed by the federal government, and something you'd get from a private bank? What would a student find different?
Well, there's a number of things that are different. It used to be that federal loans were enough to cover tuition, but as tuition has skyrocketed, the private student loan industry has really taken off as well. And federal loans come with them subsidized interest while the student is in school, whereas there were two types of federal loans, subsidized and unsubsidized.
Right.
Sorry about that.
No.
And so the difference really between the federal loans and the private loans is that the federal loans, the interest is while it accrues while the student is in school, the federal government subsidizes that, where it's in the private market, the student is responsible for the accruing interest while they're in school.
Yeah, and the other part of the
interest rates are much higher on the private
loan. Right, and the other part of the federal loan is you can never get out from under it.
Well, as of 2005, you can never get out from under your private loans either, because Congress decided to strip private loans of all of the consumer protections that almost every other type of debt in America enjoys. So now, not only is the federal taxpayer-supported student loan system stripped of all of these consumer protections like bankruptcy, now the private loan market has those protections as well.
Right, because they're federally guaranteed. So let me ask you this. You know, and a lot of the folks that I've talked to in these occupations, they're saying there's got to be some type of debt forgiveness. There's got to be, and I know your website, ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com, but there's got to be some way for people to get out from under this. You pay for X amount of time, maybe that's the answer. I've talked to people who've had jobs, they paid, they lost their job, they put it into deferral, and they're right back where they started to because the interest is accrued, and they're going to have to pay that over and over again. Why do we forgive the student debt? Why these kids? Why now? Why not people of the past? Explain that.
Because the situation today is so different than it used to be. Tuition rates have skyrocketed in the last 20 years, certainly, and that is a direct result of student loans themselves, which is really counterintuitive. But when you think about it, student loans are, the intention behind them are to give opportunities to those who can't otherwise afford to go to college. And But what we're doing routinely is saddling these people with so much debt that once they finish school, they don't earn enough money to pay back their loans, and they're in a much worse financial position than they were had they never gone to school at all. So a program that really started off with good intentions to give access to higher education to those who could otherwise not afford it has now resulted in indenturing entire generations of Americans to these debts. And there's a number of reasons why I believe that student loans should be forgiven. But I think what you're really seeing with these Occupy protests is the real fundamental sense of injustice. There's almost an awakening that's happening, that people are realizing that they're being royally screwed by the government and the Wall Street bankers, that the whole system is rigged against them. And when they took out these loans to go get an education, they did so with the intention of bettering their lives and to increase their opportunities. And what they've found, and especially the graduates of the past 3 or 4 years, what they've found is that they're in much worse financial positions than they would have been if they had never gone to school at all.
Right. Now, let me ask you this, you know, because a lot of the folks that I've talked to who are my age, maybe a couple of years younger, who went to school, they took student loans, they paid them back, because they were able to go get jobs. They're looking at these kids now and saying, well, you know what? I had to work a crummy job and I had to pay back my student loans. So since I had to do it, you too. So what do you say to someone like that who's taken this hardline position that, you know, that I did it so you should have to too and I don't care. Just stop your whining and suck it up. What do you say to someone like that?
To open your eyes and look how different the situation is today than when you graduated. First of all, like I've said now 3 times,
but here's the thing,
tuition has skyrocketed. So the amount that these people have had to borrow to obtain the very same degree that person obtained 20, 30 years ago for much less money, it doesn't have the same value that it does today. And with this now decimated job market, they can't pay it back. It's not that they don't want to pay it back. They can't.
Good point. In looking at this, let's say miraculously you could wave the wand, you could set aside all that student loan debt, and these college kids now find jobs. Would this act as something of a stimulus, you think? I've heard people argue that by taking this off the backs of students, they would then spend that money and it would help to stimulate the economy. Any validity to that argument?
That's actually how the proposal came about. About 2.5 years ago, I was getting frustrated with the debate over the Obama stimulus plan. Here it was 9 days after the inauguration of a candidate who came into office on a platform of hope and change, and there we were talking about more of the same, corporate welfare, trickle-down economics. And it occurred to me, as somebody who has student loan debt, that if you forgave my debt, I would have about $500 per month, every month, with which to spend on ailing sectors of the economy. So rather than throwing trillions of dollars at the very people who caused the economic meltdown in the first place, why not have a bottom-up, trickle-up approach to economic stimulus? Forgive student loan debt and unleash a whole new era of prosperity and entrepreneurship and innovation. All of these people who are saddled with so much student loan debt today went to school with the intention of being able to get ahead. And I think as a society, we want these people to get ahead.
Absolutely.
And because, you know, a rising tide does lift all boats. And if everybody's prosperous, then that does, you know, get spread around and everybody benefits as a result. So why is it that we're shackling entire generations of people to educational debts from which there is no escape?
So let me ask you this.
Nobody any good.
Yeah, let me ask you this then, because I know the righties are going to throw in and say, well, you know what, who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for your grand scheme? And it's a valid question. Where does this $1 trillion come from?
Well, first of all, the proposal that I put forth contemplates the forgiveness of all student loans. And I don't believe that the way that it would work would be that the federal government would have to write a check for about $1 trillion.
Right.
A lot of that number, that $1 trillion figure, is comprised of accrued interest that's capitalized, as well as exorbitant fees and penalties. If you miss one payment or if it goes into default, collections agencies can tack on upwards of 25% of the principal onto your liability. And then that gets capitalized. The interest accrues and gets capitalized onto the principal. So you have this debt that grows exponentially that you can't escape from.
So yeah, I have heard that story.
The first thing that I would have the federal government do would be to negotiate down the amount that is owed in the aggregate, because a lot of that figure is comprised of exorbitant fees, penalties, and interest that really is unfair and unconscionable. And and I don't have the numbers to tell you like how much of that is represented by the fees, penalties, and interest versus what is that was actually borrowed. But let's start there. Let's get rid of all of that accrued interest, penalties, fees, interest, and see what we're left with. And then let's see what the bill is. The taxpayers would have to foot the bill, but I think the taxpayers, this is something that the taxpayers really should be investing in, its own people.
Yeah, and even if you just did away with the interest and the fees and all that and said, look, you took out this much, this is what eventually you're going to have to pay back over a 10-year period, and if that doesn't happen, then we'll forgive some of it. I can see a number of plans popping up, but the current system's unsustainable. And I got an email from Joan who writes, Robert, when do you expect to hear something from the White House regarding our petition, which had an overwhelming signature response? What do you say to Joan?
Well, the White House promised that any petition receiving 5,000 signatures within the first 30 days would receive an official White House response. October 23rd is actually, I believe, the 30th day. We got over 5,000 signatures in 24 hours. We're well into 25,000 signatures there. We also have a petition on signon.org, which is run by moveon.org, and we have over 440,000 signatures on that petition as well. So I can't really predict when the White House is going to respond to me, but they said they would. So I'm expecting my response.
And
patiently awaiting.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear what that response is. Again, the website, ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Robert Applebaum's name. Robert, I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight, and we'd love to hear back from you real soon when and if the response comes.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
As Ray Charles sang years ago, them that's got is them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. A majority of Americans are now seeing that them that's got are not only getting theirs, but also getting ours. The wealthiest 1% of Americans possess more net worth today than the bottom 90% of us combined. Worse, these privileged few and their political henchmen have structured a new economic normal of long-term joblessness, low wages, miserly public services, and a steadily widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us. This is the alienating reality that Occupy Wall Street has chosen to confront. This burgeoning movement began in September when about a dozen college students pitched camp in Liberty Plaza in the heart of New York's financial district and began daily peaceful marches down Wall Street. This is not your grandfather's tightly organized protest. It's intentionally loose. Instead of a leader, group decisions are reached through a consensus-based democratic process. With no faith in traditional politics or conventional media, the mostly young protesters have taken to the streets, using their well-honed culture of the web to organize, strategize, harmonize, and mobilize. Their encampment might look chaotic at first, but look again. It includes a medical clinic, media center, cafeteria, and library. Food? Their widely viewed website lets anyone in the world go online and have pizzas delivered to them from a local shop. They even produce their own newspaper, appropriately named the Occupied Wall Street Journal. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York protest is growing, and the movement has now spread to more than 50 cities, from major hubs like Chicago to such smaller places as McAllen, Texas. all across the USA, something is happening here. Link into it at www.occupytogether.com. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. So, a funny tweet we just came across from T. Tagaris. He writes, 647,654 minutes, Joe Lieberman will no longer be a U.S. senator. And I'm sure it's less than that. So the countdown to Trader Joe being booted already beginning. So good times. Goodbye. You know, like they say, goodbye. See you later, Trader Joe. Anyway, let's go to the phones. I got Stosh on line one. Stosh, how are we doing tonight?
All right, Rick. How you doing tonight?
Oh, I am fantastic. What's on your mind?
Hank Williams.
Yep.
He got a job. So tell T-Twits, you should be happy. Hank Williams has a job.
Yeah, good.
He's the official greeter at the Texas governor's N-word head hunting lodge.
Yeah, I've heard that.
You heard that?
Yeah. You know, again, you know, so many people have been hung up on, you know, Hank lost his job with ESPN, and I'm going, I don't understand why you're upset he lost the job. It's the world view that the righties have been pushing.
Yep.
You know, this idea that the corporations have to honor free speech, right, shows you how little that they understand about the Constitution.
Exactly.
So what do you think about that? What do you think about Hank being the greeter there at the N Ranch?
Well, that, like Rick Perry's, that's a minimum wage job. That's right up the valley.
There you go, brother. So how you been? Life good?
Nah, it's struggling like everybody else. These jobs and people being laid off and can't get anything. It's rough out here.
What do you think of the Occupation Nation movement? What are you going to get out and participate in the protests?
Yeah, I'm going to give them a million Louisville sluggers.
No. Not going there, Stosh. Come on. You got to restrain that a little bit. Look, the people who
restrain their attacks on us.
Yeah, but here's the thing. This turns violent, we lose. Because in comes the big guns, and I don't know about your Louisville slugger. I don't know if it can take down tank shells.
Yeah, that ain't going to turn no tanks on people. That'll be cutting their own throat the way off.
If the folks in the street turn violent, the people who are not participating will demand it. And that's why this cannot be a violent movement. Cannot be. Can't have any of that stuff. And you need to condemn anyone who advocates violence in this situation. Just a thought there, Stosh.
I just had a flashback to the 60s. Just that's all. Things got done. That's all.
Yeah, but here again, it wasn't the protesters who, in my view, who really started it. It was the cops with the swinging clubs. So that's a whole different era.
Well, they're just swinging the hardships on us. That's what they're doing now. But I understand what you're saying.
And that's why we need to get back into the streets, and we need to be educating people. And that's why we need folks like you calling in, and we need to be talking about this. We need to have the conversation, brother. I appreciate it, though.
All right, Rick.
Thanks so much. Call anytime. So the question then becomes, what does Occupation Nation want? And you look at what's going on. I'm telling you, this turns violent. You find the folks who are at these protests doing dumb things. It's going to hurt the entire movement. It's going to hurt the conversation because we're not given the luxury of being the righties. The whole Tea Party movement was that there was that undercurrent of violence. They were walking around with guns. You do something dumb like that here, national exposure. But what do these folks want? I think they want accountability from the banks. You look at some of the stuff that's on here. They want to make sure that the banks are held accountable. Investigate, arrest, try, convict, jail all the people who caused this mess. That's got to be almost the first thing. Get to the bottom line. Are there no? Is there no honor among the thieves there on Wall Street? I remember the Japanese, they'd go walk into the woods and kill themselves. They call it what, Harry Carey or Hari Kari or whatever it was? They'd jab themselves in the belly and wrench the knife around. I'd pay for the knives. But not our guys, not Wall Street. Greed is good. And I look at the foreclosure mill and the government bailout recipient Bank of America. There's a place where some obvious rage should be targeted. We should be looking at these big banks and going, you know what? No more. And there's a movement of folks out there who are saying, you know what? Exactly what I've been saying for years. Get your money out of the banks. Get your money out of the banks. And Bank Transfer Day is coming up. It is November 5th. So again, please, you're encouraged, pull your money out of the bank, out of these big banks. Take it to credit unions, like our friends over at PSECU. Someone who advertises with the program. And I got to tell you, I'm okay with that. It's where my money has been for years, long before they advertise with the program. Also, November 12th is another Bankster Day of action. People are being challenged to close all of their accounts with banks considered too big to fail. We need to do that on our own. If our government's not going to break it up, we need to be thinking about this. We need to be the ones who break them up. Say, you know what? Fine. We're going to pull our money. We're going to go somewhere else. We're going to create other regional, mid-sized banks who are accountable. I mean, that seems logical, Jake. At some level, we have got to do this ourselves if the people that we've elected, well, if they're not going to.
Well, we talked about banks. I mean, you can approach that subject on several levels. I know you and I talked about when we were younger, and I remember that when they were localized banks and they kept the money in the community and invested back in the community. Now that money goes who knows where. The bigger banks all over the country, and I'm sure occasionally some of that money goes out of the country. And that's something that's another issue that you got to think of when you're talking about banks versus credit unions.
And Bank of America is a perfect target. Just recently, they came out with a $5 monthly fee on people who want to use their debit cards. Really? You're going to charge someone $5 to use your stupid little card? Answer, yes. They've spent millions of dollars lobbying to gut any oversight of the industry using our money to do it. I mean, that's what's beautiful about this whole scenario. We've been the one who've paid for our own demise. You know, this whole foreclosure crisis, they're right dead smack in the middle of this. Because remember, Countrywide was sucked up by Bank of America. So they're sitting on tons of these potentially foreclosed properties. And their CEO, this Brian Moynihan, he was excitedly cheering for faster foreclosures on these homes. Get people out quicker. We need to get those houses back. Kick them people to the curb. Also, remember, they're laying off 30,000 people. You know, hey, got to make that couple billion dollars. We need to make sure that we can save money, cut costs, cut those costs. And while we're kicking 30,000 people to the curb, let's give ourselves a nice happy raise. In fact, two of their big executives, former executives, they're going to receive a salary. This Sally Krawcheck and Joe Price, they're going to each receive $850,000. For the year, plus a payment of $5.15 million. And their CEO, he's going to get $950,000 in salary and $9.05 million in stock. Now, let's stop and think about this for a second. This is that argument that I've been talking about for some time, wages versus capital gains. On the $850,000 that Sally Krawcheck was handed in salary, she's going to pay a 35% tax rate on that $850,000. She's going to pay about $297,500. But on that $5.15 million, she's going to pay $772,000. So overall, for what will be $6 million, she'll pay just over $1 million. Or somewhere in the neighborhood of 17% taxes. How many people out there swinging a hammer today? Now, this is before any tax avoidance. This is before any of the loopholes. This is before any deductions. This, you know, her fancy lunches, her chauffeur driver, her tickets to this, her tickets to that. Before any of that stuff. 17%. If she did nothing, how much did you pay last year in federal tax? Maybe you can take a look at this. I look at their CEO. $10 million. Of that $10 million, $950,000 of it in wages. So he'll pay about $332,000 in tax on those wages. He'll pay about $1.3 million in capital gains. So you're looking at $1.69 million on $10 million. So, of course, do the quick math. It's 16.9%. That's before he does anything to get away from paying taxes. And yet we don't have a problem in this country with tax rates. You're talking about a guy who made $10 million paying 16%, just over, paying almost 17%. There are people who are busting their behinds building houses and hanging wire and who pay that. And yet the righties will tell you those working people need to pay more. It's a damn shame. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break, back after that.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make that way to happen!
Since the investor class, diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference. Avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, email rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And, you know, getting back to this whole bank thing. The folks over at Think Progress did a really nice job of coming together with 11 reasons why we need to have a look at the banking industry. For instance, you know, the bank profits are at the highest level they have been since before the recession. I mean, so the profits are there. The industry, since the second quarter of 2007, has had the best quarter, which ran around $36.8 billion in earnings. That's pretty amazing, especially when you look at the fact that you've got the Bank of America's, the Barclays, the Goldman Sachs, the Credit Suisse saying, you know what, we need to make sure that we're more profitable. We want to make sure we're going to cut costs and synergize and do all that other stuff, all corporate-y things. And we're going to throw tens of thousands of people in the streets. Bank of America alone, 30,000 people. And where do you think those people are going to come from? Here. In fact, most of the job loss will be here again. And one of the things that I looked at, I'm going, it just blows my mind that the banking sector, the financial sector in this country, accounts for almost a third of total corporate profits in this country. Now, while that sounds staggering, the banking industry, the people who just shuffle money from one pocket to the other, they account for a third. It was worse before the recession. It was 40% back then. You could thank, again, one of the reasons the folks in the occupation movement are saying, look, get rid of Graham Leach Bliley. Go back to the days of Glass-Steagall. And I look at this and I go, you know, there's something wrong here, which is why I think it's a great idea to get your money out of these banks, because as the folks at Think Progress point out, since 2008, the biggest banks have only gotten bigger. They've swallowed up competition. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, they're now bigger than they were pre-recession. And again, too big to fail, a problem. So you look at the four biggest banks, the Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup. 50% of all mortgages are in those four companies. 66% of all credit cards in those four companies. The 10 biggest banks hold 60% of all banking assets. Now just go back to the Reagan days, the day before Reagan took office. Those 10 biggest banks only controlled 22%. So stop and think about how this mass consolidation, how this, we need mergers and acquisition, and we need to synergize. We need synergy. Synergy, good thing. Gonna bring people together. Gonna get rid of redundancy. Whenever you hear redundancy, think people, goodbye people, to the curb. You're fired. There's the door. But you start and you look at this, man. The six biggest banks hold assets equal to 63% of the country's GDP. That is a real problem. The five biggest banks hold 95% of the derivatives. Again, you look at this and you go, there's a problem here. And yet we're not taking this head on. We're really kind of just putting our head down and going, oh, okay. And the Obama administration has not done anything to this. In fact, if anything, they've done everything they can do to encourage more of it. I called early on. The mortgage thing, take care of it immediately. Should have been one of the first things, first 100 days. This is the problem with Democrats. Oh, we want to be democratic. We want to have everyone to have their voice. So what they did, they said, hey, Max Baucus, figure out how to screw this whole system up. And he did. And we're surprised. I may not agree with the Republicans on very, very many things. But the reality is when they have a veto-proof majority, and we're seeing it here in the state of Pennsylvania, they'll just steamroll you. They don't care about democracy. That's just a problem. And once we got the numbers, we don't have to worry about that. We can do our backroom deals. We can steamroll through. And this is why I think the folks in this occupation thing have got the right idea. Democrats are not the answer. Republicans are not the answer. Independents not the answer. It's the people who are the answer. Getting folks out in the street and saying, the hell with what's going on. We want something that works for us. About time.
You've been out there and you talk to these kids. Well, and some of them aren't kids, but some of them are. You find out that they're not just mad at the Republicans. They're mad at the Democrats, too. They're mad at Congress.
I'm mad at the Democrats.
At the system. I mean, the Democrats are, shall I say, I'll be nice, they're quasi-embracing them. They're embracing him, but yet they're keeping him at arm's length. The truth is that some in their party are the very problem that these people are protesting.
Well, what they're hoping is that they can create their Tea Party, and that this will be the movement that counters the Tea Party. And look, I don't know that anybody wants to be that in these movements. They want to actually be able to, have a job, feed their kids, do some rational things. You know, now there are some fringe folks there, but at the end of it, man, it's about the group movement. I think
this does scare the other side. I mean, look at I don't think it's an accident, Rick, that you hear the shrill reaction to what's going on. And here you hear Glenn Beck saying they will drag you out of your house and kill you. I mean, come on,
violent hippies.
Let's get real here, and it's not just Glenn Beck. It's all over. The right wing is really reacting. Kind of very, very violently in their own way.
I love the violent hippie frame. It just goes against everything I've ever thought of hippies. Violent, these angry, marauding hippies with spiked bats.
But I heard a local talk show host, and again, I'm not going to say who it was, but he's calling these people un-American.
Well,
yet he's the same person. You know, he was effusive with his praise of the Tea Party, and when the Tea Party talked about the Constitution, if you look at their history, what do they think the Boston Tea Party was? What do they think the Revolution, hello, was about? It was about people standing up to the system and saying enough is enough. That's why we have, a country called America.
You gotta love the hypocrisy. The very people who pushed for, who advocated for, who promoted, who backed, who funded all of these angry Tea Party outbursts, going to these meetings and causing a scene, going to these meetings and disrupting. They were all in favor of that. Oh, that's just great. Oh, look at him. He's standing up. He's fighting for himself. But, you know, anybody else does that, they're terrorists, or they're just union thugs, or they don't know what they're doing, and they don't know why they're there. They're morons. They're jobless. They're lazy. All of the frames that the right has been throwing out there. And again, you know, when you control the media, I guess you can do that. When you control the airwaves as they do, you can get away with it. And that's what they're doing. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Mark Anderson from the Daily Kos Labor page about what's going on in Wisconsin. The Scott Walker recall, here we go. Interesting stuff. Also going to talk about the Walker policies and some job loss. I thought he was going to bring jobs. We're back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American standard of living is in decline as household income for working families continues to fall. According to the Census Bureau, inflation-adjusted median household income fell 9.8% from the start of the Bush Great Recession through June of 2011. The report on household income by Census Bureau officials Gordon W. Green Jr. and John F. Coder said this household income decline is a significant reduction in the American standard of living. So our economic system not only is failing to create nearly enough jobs for us, those of us who still have jobs are watching our income go down in what is supposed to be an economic recovery. Princeton economic professor Henry S. Farber also found that workers who found work again after losing their jobs made an average of 17.5% less in their new jobs. As the United Auto Workers Union worked Monday to reach a deal with Chrysler on a new four-year labor contract, UAW leaders called local bargaining units to a Detroit meeting. Chrysler is complaining that the GM and Ford deals are too rich, despite the fact that those deals increased labor costs by just 1% at GM and Ford. Both the UAW and Chrysler say they want to reach a negotiated deal and not go to arbitration. Arbitration must take into consideration the compensation for workers at foreign plants operating in the U.S. UAW total compensation is still higher than those plants. The contract for 23,000 UAW workers at Chrysler expired September 14th. Honeywell workers in Kansas City are on strike. Jesse Russell has more.
2 months ago, United Steelworkers ratified a 3-year contract agreement with Honeywell International's uranium processing facility in Metropolis. That agreement ended a 13-month-long lockout of workers at the plant. Honeywell is now facing a strike at a Kansas City plant, with workers putting down their tools on Sunday. The most recent contract offer was rejected by 79% of voting employees, and 85% voted to strike. The employees are represented by the International Association of Machinists, who issued a statement saying the company is negotiating in bad faith over a 3-year contract. The machinists plan to file unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board. The union has declined to reveal the allegations due to the NLRB being closed Monday for a federal holiday.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The right to bargain is the right that's fundamentally about power to the people. That's where it should be. It's called justice. It's called democracy. So hear this, Scott Walker, because your time is limited. Let us tell you what your big problem really is. It ain't your nagging, finger wagging, budget deficit. The problem lies with your moral deficit.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So, you know, when we were there in February, it was, I think, the beginning of this whole occupation idea. It put it in people's minds that, you know what, we can take to the streets and we can do it in a peaceful fashion and have our voices heard. And I think that is a great thing, and I think the more that this occupation thing goes across the country, the more we may see of this, I'm hoping. But the other part of this is I'm hoping that Scott Walker gets recalled and they boot him out of office. That's if, from what I'm hearing, they don't indict him for something else first. Anyway, that's why I've asked Mark Anderson. He's one of the writers over at Daily Kos's labor page. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you guys coming back on with us. You know, I look at what's going on there, and it looks like the recall efforts beginning to ramp up.
Yeah, it looks like we're going to start collecting signatures on the 15th of November. And then I believe they're going to try and get the recall election scheduled sometime in either January or February.
That will be why do you guys always pick the coldest weather to do things in?
Well, it's a law that that takes a year to get them in there, but I guess we're just hardy folks.
There you go. Because when we were there in February, it was bitter cold, and sleeping on that marble floor didn't do my back any good.
Well, you're a better man than I, because I came home every night.
you live there. We were too cheap to spring for the hotel for the night. But here's the thing. I mean, Walker swept into office saying, I'm going to create jobs, I'm going to change things. Not the radical change that's happened. That's not what he ran on. But he said he's going to create jobs. How's that working out so far?
Well, it came out last night that the largest home builder in Dane County has laid off 40% of its workforce.
40%?
40%. This is a company that was really not hurt that much during the recession. As a matter of fact, about a block down from my house was one of their latest subdivisions. They were building it during the recession. And because Madison is kind of the hub of government in Wisconsin, you have a lot of public sector workers living here.
Right.
And when their paychecks got cut, it started rolling downhill fast.
And that's the thing I don't think the righties get. By stealing wages, by stealing from these working people, that's going to harm all of the small businesses that they claim to so love.
Right. Well, not only did it, hurt home sales here in new homes, where Viridian, the company actually built my house, had to lay off 40% of their workforce. It also came out this morning that new car sales in Dane County are down. We're the only county in the state where they're down because of the concentration of public sector workers here.
Wow. So again, what they're talking about then is you're going to kill the capital area, make that a poverty region, in the hopes that maybe it spreads outside. Is that the thinking maybe?
Well, the Republicans have always hated Madison. I mean, if you look, I mean, we've actually, it's kind of funny. A couple of years ago, we had a Republican legislator from Whitewater. His name is Steve Nass. He hates Madison, hates the university system. And a couple of years ago, he didn't like the way we plowed our streets. And he said that the state should take over the plowing of Madison City streets because we didn't put enough salt down.
Wow.
Well, we don't put a lot of salt down because we have four lakes that the city's built on and don't want them to turn into the Great Salt Lakes.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, this is the kind of mentality we have to deal with in Madison, because you have these right-wingers that hate the city of Madison because the capital's here. So anything they can do to punish Madison, they will do it. And I think this is kind of a roundabout way for them to punish the city.
So this claim of creating jobs, is there any validity to his claim? He's going to create, what was it, 250,000 jobs?
He's going to create 250,000 jobs. And I don't know if you heard, but a couple of weeks ago, it came out that the state-run website that lists job postings that are open in the state, about half the jobs on the state were out of state.
That's one way to appear to be creating jobs. Send your citizens out of the state.
Yeah, and then he also last week, I believe it was last week, had a conference. I can't remember what city it was in. I think it was up in the Fox Valley somewhere, where he discussed with only invited business leaders, so basically campaign donors, and how these business leaders of the state told him. They have jobs open, but they can't get anyone to take them because they won't get off unemployment.
Yeah, I've heard that frame so many times. In fact, I was just talking to a fairly conservative businessman this past weekend who said, I want to go down to that occupation thing with 100 of my friends and offer those people jobs, but I know they wouldn't take them. And I go, well, what would you pay them? Well, we would pay a minimum wage like we used to earn. And there's that mentality, and I'm sure you're going to find a couple of businessmen who say, yeah, I'm looking for people. We're paying minimum wage with no benefits and no future and no security or any of that stuff. So, yeah, we want you to dump that unemployment where we're paying. You're probably making $8 or $9 an hour on it, feeding your family and supporting the community. But we're going to pay you minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. And minimum wage isn't even a livable wage. It's not even close. I mean, you know, interesting point about that is a good friend of mine, through a fluke at work, I was able to get him a job after he'd been unemployed since February, because his company up and moved to a right-to-work state. So he's, 20 years there, and he's out of a job.
That's a shame.
So, it just happened to be a fluke. Ended up just quitting, and I told my boss about it. She said, yeah, well, the temp agency she has to go through would only pay him, I think it was, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was $12 an hour, which if he had done that, he would not have had enough money to put his child in daycare and work. Whereas unemployment, if he could stay home, it made enough that they could still take their house payments.
Right. And then that's
luckily, the problem. He was able to get a couple dollars extra an hour, but it's just frustrating. He wants to work, but he can't find the job, until this one, where he would get paid enough to be able to put his child in daycare.
And that really goes to show that the whole system, that we need to be rethinking not just the unemployment system, but the entire system and how the economy works for people who actually have to go to work and try and raise their kids. And I know I hear so many of my way out friends saying, well, I had to do it, so you should have to do it too, which seems to be the mentality, but it just seems kind of nuts to me.
It is, and I look at my dad, and I talked to you about this before. My dad was a truck driver here in Madison, a union truck driver. And if I take his wages from the early 80s and adjust them for inflation, my dad made more money driving truck than I do working in IT.
Because you had a union there who fought for parts of the profits.
Yeah, I mean, the union was there. But, also look at it, you have to look at it this way. That same truck driving job today is paying the same price, same amount of money it was paying in 1982.
Absolutely.
And, we can't keep going on like this.
And that's what I tell people. You know, I've often said my grandmother worked at a small department store in Cleveland. And at the time, she was making $8 an hour. 1985, making $8 an hour. The people working at Walmart today don't make much more than $8 an hour, some 26 years later.
No, no. And you know, you can't, you know, I can't see society going on much further, you know, where it's going to be civilized, you know, before it deteriorates to a Mad Max type thing, unless we straighten out this income inequity. I mean, there's no reason that a CEO should be making 450 times more than the average employee that he has.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it comes back down to the fact that you don't have strong labor unions to fight for that.
Right.
Do you have an occupation movement there in Madison? I mean, because to me, this could be the beginning of something that brings this to light. Now, some of the folks I've talked to didn't know anything about unions, and from my perspective, it's an opportunity to educate them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the people I've talked to, you know, they're open to the idea.
Yeah, we do have an occupation movement here. It's just getting started. It's still somewhat disorganized. I was down there for their first night on Friday night. It was very disorganized, but they're getting better. The police have been working with them fairly well, although they had to leave the park that they were at and they have moved to a different park. I don't know how the police are going to handle that. I haven't heard much on it, but the police in Madison generally tend to be pretty cool about these things.
Yeah, I mean, when we were there, I mean, all of the police that I ran into, decent folks.
Yeah, well, they're part of this group. They're union officers. They know what's at stake.
You know, I look at this, and you know, the same exact things that the folks who are in this occupation movement are fighting for are kind of the things that, you know, they should be looking at themselves as well.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I think. Eventually, I think you're going to see a lot more people coming around once they figure out what this is actually about. I think right now there's a lot of, you know, I saw an interview last night on CBS News, and I can't remember the news person, but he was going around asking people what this occupation was about. He has three people, he got three different answers. I don't think it's about one single thing. It's about a lot of things. It's about people like Dan Snyder from the Washington Redskins going out and buying a $70 billion boat when there are people starving. It's about people that are going out and trying to sell their mansions for $3 million and thinking that's not enough money, so we're going to ask for $4 million, and somebody's going to pay it just so they can say they paid $4 million for the house.
Yep.
Because there's such an income inequity in this country that 1% can do that.
And I think you're right. I think, for me, I've been saying, you know, this is a whole bunch of people who they have a common thread. They're ticked off that the economy is just not working for them.
Yeah, it's working for the people that are in that 1%. Everybody else, it's not working. It's just not. You know, I look at the condos that are behind my house here. They have been sitting empty for, you know, as long as I've been living here. And I've been here about 5-6 years. They're not selling. You know, what does that do to my property value?
Well, it tanks it, which is why, you know, this whole thing with the foreclosures, I'm worried about, because we could have another housing bubble burst and down go the property values of everybody again.
Well, you know, the answer to a lot of these foreclosures is we have a lot of people that are homeless right now. And there's a lot of empty houses. There's no reason that the government cannot say, hey, we're going to buy up these properties dirt cheap, and we're going to let people move into them, you know, just to get people back on their feet or something, some type of a program like that.
Yeah,
and, you know, maybe make it a rent-to-own type of situation or something. But get these things, you know, occupied so that we don't have people going in and stealing the pipes and the wiring and going down to the recycling center and selling it.
Yep, and which is going on all across the country.
It is.
And it's an absolute shame, but this is what happens when you leave those properties empty. What we also need is we need a jobs plan to create good jobs because, you know, the economy's it never stays still. It's either spiraling upwards, either you're creating good jobs and more jobs are creating more good jobs and you're going up, or you're spiraling down, which right now the Republicans seem to want to take us down.
I think they want to tank the economy just so they can get back in charge. I think that's obvious.
Well, it is obvious.
You know, but it kind of reminds me of, you know, when I went to the first Occupy Madison meeting, the park it was at, right across, or kitty corner to it, was a WPA project called Bree Stevens Field. And I thought it was kind of fitting that the first Occupy Madison was right across the street from a WPA project.
Yeah, that is pretty fitting.
Because that's the kind of projects we need right now to get this, get our economy moving and get people back to work.
Especially when we can borrow money so cheaply. I mean, people like to talk about how deeply in debt we are, and we are. But right now is the time to borrow because the rates are so attractive, and it could help us build our infrastructure, get people back to work, and start that spiraling upward to where you're creating good jobs and more jobs are being created, and you have a spiral up.
Exactly, and that's what we need to do. I mean, I look at the park that's just down the road from me. It's got one swing set and a tiny tent-like shelter. You know, why can't we hire somebody to maybe put up a nice play set, build an actual shelter, and make something nice? Everything back?
There you go again, talking crazy, investing in our future.
Well, I can't help it. I'm a crazy liberal.
How dare you talk in that craziness, asking someone to pay for that, like the Koch brothers. How dare you?
Yeah, what can I say? I'm one of them crazy Wisconsin folks.
And that's what we like about you. Mark Anderson, Daily Kos Labor. I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you guys. Do fantastic work over there at the Labor Page.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
I'm fighting till the end, and we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town, all down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
As Ray Charles sang years ago, then this got is then that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. A majority of Americans are now seeing that them that's got are not only getting theirs, but also getting ours. The wealthiest 1% of Americans possess more net worth today than the bottom 90% of us combined. Worse, these privileged few and their political henchmen have structured a new economic normal of long-term joblessness, low wages, miserly public services, and a steadily widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us. This is the alienating reality that Occupy Wall Street has chosen to confront. This burgeoning movement began in September when about a dozen college students pitched camp in Liberty Plaza in the heart of New York's financial district and began daily peaceful marches down Wall Street. This is not your grandfather's tightly organized protest. It's intentionally loose. Instead of a leader, group decisions are reached through a consensus-based democratic process. With no faith in traditional politics or conventional media, the mostly young protesters have taken to the streets, using their well-honed culture of the web to organize, strategize, harmonize, and mobilize. Their encampment might look chaotic at first, but look again. It includes a medical clinic, media center, cafeteria, and library. Food? Their widely viewed website lets anyone in the world go online and have pizzas delivered to them from a local shop. They even produce their own newspaper, appropriately named the Occupied Wall Street Journal. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York protest is growing, and the movement has now spread to more than 50 cities, from major hubs like Chicago to such smaller places as McAllen, Texas. All across the USA, something is happening here. Link into it at www.occupytogether.com.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Someone tell the GOP that Ohio's not for sale. So we're singing, hey, John Kasich, don't sell us out.
Yeah.
you know, the folks in Ohio are standing up and fighting back. And, you know, you look at this November election that's coming up, this SB5 bill that they rammed through, like Republicans do. You know, they've got the power. They're going to jam it through. They're going to jam it you know where. Well, they did that. But in Ohio, they have the ability to go back and through referendum. They say, you know what, we're going to put it on the ballot. We're going to let the people vote on it. And they needed something like 280,000 signatures. They got somewhere in the 1.3 million signature range. This is going to be an interesting election. And this issue is, you know, it's like I talked about yesterday, where my grandmother lives there in the suburb just outside of Cleveland. It's one of those issues that is really tearing apart communities. It's tearing apart neighbors. One neighbor's for it, one's against it. And it's really, the wealth class has done a very nice job. If you give them, you got to give them the credit. They have picked an issue that people will fight over. Another reason for people to be divided. You know, either non-union, union, either you're white, black, white collar, blue collar. You know, they've done a nice job of sectioning us off. And now this, either you're for stealing collective bargaining rights or you're not. And what I found interesting is the folks at We Are Ohio, they ran this ad featuring a grandmother from Cincinnati, Ohio, whose great-granddaughter was saved by an Ohio fireman. And, you know, she goes on to say, look, you know, we need to have these firefighters, and these firefighters need to have their rights protected. You know, this is, you know, we need qualified, trained people. Well, here's the ad right here.
When the fire broke out, there wasn't a moment to spare. If not for the firefighters, we wouldn't have our Zoe today. That's why it is so important to vote no on Issue 2. Issue 2 makes it illegal to negotiate for enough firefighters to do their job. And these firefighters, they know what they need as far as equipment and manpower. How many of those politicians in Columbus have fought a fire, have been short manpower? The politicians don't care about the middle class. They turn their backs on all of us. I don't want the politicians in Columbus making decisions for the firefighters, the police, teachers, nurses, or any organization that's helping people. Fewer firefighters can mean the difference between life or death. And that's why I'm voting no on Issue 2.
Yeah, so they came out with this and they said, you know, look, you know, you heard the ad. You know, you don't want politicians dictating the terms on the job. That should be something that's negotiated. That should be something that the firemen and their employer, the city or the state, sit down and negotiate. People close to the problem, not bureaucrats. So you got this group out there, this euphemistically named Building a Better Ohio. And, of course, you know, this euphemistically named front group supports stealing collective bargaining rights away. They're airing a commercial that basically takes Granny's words there, splices them up and dices them up, and basically coming out with a message, again, opposite of what Granny had to say. Here's this ad.
When the fire broke out, there wasn't a moment to spare. If not for the firefighters, we wouldn't have our Zoe today.
She's right. By voting no on Issue 2, our safety will be threatened. Without Issue 2, communities will need to lay off hardworking firefighters to pay for the excessive benefits of other governments. Issue 2 protects our communities from losing those who protect us.
Fewer firefighters can mean the difference between life or death.
Vote yes on Issue 2.
So you listen to that and you got to go, at some level, there's got to be something against taking her words and skewing them the way they have. But on another level, there's this idea that, oh, well, you know, if we can steal away from those firemen, if we can steal their wages, we can steal their benefits, we can hire more of them and steal theirs as well. And gee, think of how much money we'll save when we steal all of that back. It's kind of nuts. But that's the argument that they've taken. You know, that's the direction they've gone with it.
Of some people, they're going to look at it, well, you know, if they don't have a union and their benefits aren't as good, my taxes might be a little bit lower.
But that's never the case. I mean, I've not seen that happen.
But some people, that's how they believe. And you can bet those who are trying to take away benefits and union rights are going to exploit that weakness in people.
So, you know, where's the next step? We're going to steal rights away from people to collectively bargain, which they're trying to do in Ohio, which they're doing across the country. What's the next step? I mean, if we're going to be able, if states are going to be able, and local governments are going to be able to steal wages back, what's next? Well, there's the Georgia plan. And I don't know if you saw this, Camden County, Georgia. An interesting idea. They're going to take prisoners, of which there are an awful lot, and they're going to train these prisoners to become firefighters. As the article says, a select group of inmates may be exchanging their prison jumpsuits for firefighting gear in Camden County. They're calling it the Inmate to Firefighters Program. And it's one of several, according to the article, one of these several money-saving options that the Board of County Commissioners are looking into. And you know why they're looking into this? Because the local taxpayers are angry because their fire protection is pathetic. Now, there's this little group. What they do is they go around and they assess how safe your local community is. They say, you know what, if you have a fire station more than 10 miles from your house, they're more than 10 miles apart, we got a problem. If you have a staffing problem, if you have a shortage, if you don't have enough adequate firefighters, adequate substations, you don't have adequate equipment, they're going to raise your homeowner's insurance rates. And the numbers that I've seen, because this rating service, the insurance service office, their new standards have gone in, they're going to see raises in like a $100,000 home. The insurance just in fire protection will go from about $534 a year up to $1,277. Because what's going on is this county rating is going to drop from a class 4 to a class 10. Now, that's, you don't really need to know all that, but the reality is what's going to happen is in order to protect your home from fire, your rates are going to skyrocket. And why are they going to skyrocket? Because you haven't invested in your community to have the fire protection that you need. This is the for-profit industry saying, wait a minute, you taxpayers, you government, you local officials, you're not protecting the community. And you're going to make us hold the bag for your ineptitude. We're going to end up having to pick up hundreds of thousands of more claims because you refuse to do the right thing. Now, what's interesting is the idea of going, oh, well, we want to have prisoners be firefighters. And the program that they're working on, if it's approved, would be open to inmates who've committed only low-level crimes, of course, such as drug offenses and theft. And when I read that, I'm going, you know, when my house burned, you know, it was just a huge hole through the middle of the house. Most of our valuables, my wife's jewelry, for instance, of which before we had children, I was pretty good at buying jewelry. And she had about $10,000 worth of stuff sitting in her boxes. You're going to put somebody who, you know, has, you know, that background going through the things and you don't expect him to start pocketing things? And even if he doesn't, the fact that you have someone who has the propensity for maybe partaking in some things that aren't his, maybe you have open up a problem of someone claiming that. You know, that's just a whole thought. They also say they're going to have, you know, they have to have a record of good behavior. You know, so good con men, you know, they always seem to know how to act just right. And they have to pass the interview process and agree not to use cell phones, have visitors, or leave the station unless responding to an emergency. One violation in the program will send you back to the big house. So I find this interesting. And, you know, the money shot for me came from one of the guys who is on the committee who said, I'm not here to try and get inmate firefighters. What I'm trying to do is operate our county as economically as I can. And, you know, I took from that, well, if that's the case, I would like to operate my business as economically as possible. Can I have some free prison labor? Can we, you know, why don't we just let every corporation take advantage of free prison labor? Would that be a good idea? But wait, we do have the Georgia plan. Gonna let people work for free. So why not just skip all the pretense that they're actually looking for a job, and let's just use prison labor. Sounds like a great idea. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ike Gitlin from the Alliance for American Manufacturers about the jobs bill that the vote today and about the currency manipulation. Back after this.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. I want Congress to pass a set of trade deals. Send a message to Congress to come to an agreement on trade deals.
They're selling make-believe, and we don't buy that deal. Cause in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So the currency oversight bill went through 63-35, but not for the Chinese not trying to stop it. And I was looking at a Reuters story, the big headline exclusive, China launches lobbying push on currency bill. And I stopped and I thought about this. You know, I'm reading through the article. They set up a 12-member congressional liaison team so that the Chinese government would have a lobbying arm inside of our Congress. I mean, it's amazing. They've hired blue-chip Washington law firms for $35,000 a month to fight on the behest of the Chinese. It's remarkable. But the bill went through anyway. Here to talk a little bit about the bill and the jobs bill and a whole bunch of stuff, our good friend Ike Gitlin from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Ike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm looking at this currency oversight bill that passed 63-35, and about time, I think.
Oh, way overdue, and wouldn't have happened if it, hasn't been such a severe issue that we had quite a few Republicans finally break ranks with Mitch McConnell and vote for it.
You know, I listened to some of the arguments from Senator Sessions, And I'm sitting here, boy, I wish I was recording this because I got to be honest, I don't think I've heard a Republican talk that passionately about protecting American jobs and protecting American manufacturing as he was there about currency manipulation. But here again, on the other side, he was, you know, one of these free trade guys as well.
Well, you know, Sessions is one of a number of people in the Congress who have finally, you know, had enough from their constituents in terms of complaints and can no longer, you know, continue to adopt free trade ideology. It's you know, just pretty clear to anybody that's got any manufacturing left that they're not going to have much of an economy unless they start to deal with the Chinese. And that's what this is all about.
So I got a number of emails because I've been talking about this issue for some time now. And now that it's kind of come to a head, I've gotten a number of emails from people going, well, we've now fired the opening shot in the trade war. And I got to be honest, I don't think so.
Well, you know, the way we view it within the steelworkers and AAM is that we're in a trade war. We've been in a trade war. And, you know, that opening shot and a lot more after it, you know, have gone on without a response from us. And, you know, there's been a lot of bullying by China in a lot of ways, you know, to try to cow our politicians and try to keep us, you know, from really enforcing agreements that they made with us, and then turn around and accuse us of starting a trade war. The truth of the matter is that this is a piece of enforcement legislation. This is about them keeping good to the agreements they made when they ascended to the WTO. And to learn how to be a trading partner in a global system that allows a level playing field. There's a lot more to be done. This is the first step, if it can be brought out of the House and if it gets past the president's signature, this would be the first step in trying to deal with a number of issues that amount to subsidies.
What do you think the chances of getting it out of the House is going to be? Because, you know, early indications, Boehner's not all that thrilled with it.
Well, you know, we've racked up some 227 co-sponsors, a historic high of co-sponsors for any piece of House legislation. The Senate now has passed this, and it will get passed on to the House. There is a discharge petition circulating in the House, and although at this point it is, you know, pretty much a Democratic signed petition, it has the potential to pull it out of the Ways and Means Committee, which is Dave Camp's committee, and put it on the floor of the House. The pressure that was put on to senators on the Republican side, and by the way, a number of Democrats who've been singing hosannas to free trade for a long time, that same pressure is on the United States House members, and in some ways more so because you know, they've got less number of citizens per district, and much more open to swings and votes, and much more open to pressure from their constituents.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got Boehner and Camp bottling the thing up in the House Ways and Means, but you've got an increasingly restless Congress rank and file that's understanding that they've got to make some moves here. And you know, the folks that we've got up there on Occupy Wall Street and across the country that have been protesting about jobs and all are part of that pressure, make no mistake about it. You know, that's being looked on very closely. There's a connection between, you know, what's happening in the streets of this country and how these representatives are starting to act.
Absolutely. And do you think that, you know, because early on I thought the Tea Party folks would be on board with this. It would be something naturally that that they would take to. What's your sense of the self-described Tea Party caucus and the folks in there on how they'll vote in the House?
Well, you know, you don't have to look very far. Take a look at the co-sponsor list that we have in the House. We've got a tremendous number of conservative Republicans who have signed on. It's kind of strange politics. It's sort of, you know, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and the conservative wing of the Republican Party have come together on this issue and are squeezing the middle.
So what are the chances of Obama signing this? Did you have any indication one way or another? I know he's been kind of silent on it. Thoughts?
Well, my thought on it is, you know, that if the House and Senate both pass a bill, and by the way, the House bill is different than the Senate bill, so there has to be a reconciliation of some sort with regard to that. But assume they get on the same page with a bill, this gets, you know, passed through both the houses of Congress. I think Obama's in a position where he can't afford not to sign it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, he's made some noises about it has to be compliant with international trade agreements. And, you know, so his one out might be, you know, that it's not compliant. But I believe if it finally comes out of both the House and the Senate, it will be compliant, be judged to be compliant. And he'll be in Elvis' spot. He made a pledge to us you know, that he was going to do this stuff and he was going to straighten this stuff out. We had him in Pittsburgh along with Hillary Clinton during the primary race in 2008. He made those commitments to us. And you know, he's going to have to go against his own commitments. You know, I personally believe he'll end up doing it. I mean, it's one of these things I think where, you know, there's all kinds of pressures on the presidency. And I think he has to be in a position where he says, you know, to the Chinese and others, hey, I just can't do anything else. I mean, this thing has gotten to a point that I have to act.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the whole purpose of this. The whole purpose of this is to put pressure on both the Chinese and the administration because diplomacy has not worked.
And at the end of it, it's about creating jobs. And I've seen some numbers upwards of, you know, 2.5 million jobs could be created if we had a some type of balance in trade with just the Chinese.
Well, it's not just, you know, it's not just jobs. You know, one of the things that nobody has ever heard in the debate about the debt reduction is that there's a huge debt reduction that comes along with balancing the trade deficit.
Yep.
And so, you know, you get multiple things. You get all these jobs. You get a reduction in the trade deficit. You know, out of these jobs, you get good jobs that help pay taxes and revitalize communities and start to solve some of these issues that we have that are social issues because we've basically been hauling out our economy. And it starts to just move things all in the right direction. You know, to a strange degree, the Chinese government itself is kind of caught because, you know, its main concern right now is instability because of, you know, employment shifts that they have. And so they're in a position where they constantly promise that they're going to do something about this, but in the end don't. And so to the extent that, you know, they can blame us for it, you know, it does give them an out, too. You know, and nobody's looking for, you know, a way to destabilize the Chinese and their government and all that out of this. That's not what we're looking for.
But
what we are looking for is a fair level playing field so our domestic manufacturers can compete honestly and fairly. And if they do, they'll win some and they'll lose some, but this thing that we've got going right now, we're the only country in the world that's running a $273 billion a year trade deficit and draining our country of its best jobs and wrecking our economy.
Yeah, and at the end of this, it comes down to that whole trade argument. But for me, I think what has to happen is we need to have a trade model set up not on who can produce the cheapest, but on having economies that consume their own goods. You know, I was listening to some of the testimony on the free trade stuff this afternoon, and Rod Wyden came out with this statement that in Oregon, for them to send beef to South Korea, there's a 40% tariff on beef from Oregon to South Korea. But when the South Koreans send beef here, there's a 4% tariff. And my thought was, that's horrible, the tariffs are so screwed up, but why are we trading beef? I mean, shouldn't we be consuming our beef, and they're consuming theirs, and what we can't produce, we then trade for? I mean, isn't that the way trade is supposed to work?
Well, you're absolutely right. And there, you know, there's another spillover. You know, because of the way the trade agreement's been set up, and a tremendous amount of cheap factory-produced food has floated into these other countries, they've ruined the small plot agricultural industry in these countries, and so they've taken people who had at least a bit of a living, you know, off of plots of land in these countries like Mexico and other places, and they end up being an immigration problem for us, and so there's a spillover to this whole model that just isn't working, and it isn't working for us, and it isn't working for these other nations, with the exception of a few top dogs who are sucking in all the money. And that's what you're up against. You're up against the money people who have made tremendous amounts of money out of this. It's a short-term game. You know, long-term, it's not sustainable. It's falling apart all across the world. And, you know, we're the leaders of it. And, you know, we've got to take our rightful place in demanding a much better trading, design, just like what you talked about. And in a lot of other ways too, taking into consideration the total effect. If you actually add it up, you know, the savings that people have out of buying products cheaper in these kinds of situations versus what the cost is to the American economy and people's wages and quality of life and communities and pollution and all the rest of it. You know, there's no question that we're not winning out of this even economically.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, the thing is we're still talking about doing more of these insane agreements. You know, I sat and I listened to it today. And, you know, the thing is I sat not more than 20 feet away from the president when he was candidate Obama. And, you know, well, he said this.
You can trust me. You can trust me. when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers, that they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
You know, sat 20 feet from the guy. Do these three free trade agreements offer what that promise?
Well, you know, to be fair to the president, he is the first president in a long, long time that's done anything about enforcement. He's done a number of enforcement actions and specific products that have resulted, by the way, not in a trade war, but in bringing jobs back to the United States and using our enforcement mechanisms. In the process of pursuing a 301 case on renewables, of future products. So I don't want to, you know, pillory and vilify President Obama on the trade issue completely. However, when you take a look at the three agreements that are sitting in front of the Congress that were just sent up recently, they have not changed from the NAFTA design. Now, there's a claim that in the Colombian agreement, there's a provision to set up a mechanism to stop the killing of union people. The people that we have working on that not only don't see that, but what they're seeing is continued execution of union people and priests and religious leaders in Colombia. So, you know, there's this idea, and I think Obama, you know, would claim that he has changed these agreements and they're not the same design. But others looking at it don't conclude that there's any material difference in these, and therefore they should be rejected based on his own statement.
Are these agreements going to create the jobs that we're told they're going to create? Because what I'm seeing is job losses.
Well, you know, you take the Korean agreement, the way it's designed, it actually becomes a conduit for the rest of the world to use Korean products to flow all kinds of component parts and whatnot into finished product that comes into this country, mainly in the form of automobiles. And so it's not only as bad as NAFTA. You know, our sense of it is that it's a calamity. And there's nobody other than those that are the proponents of it, you know, that would say different. And there's all these wild claims about them creating jobs and all that. But that goes away pretty quickly. There's some sense that the Korean government has already promised their producers that any tariffs that we put on, even in the first couple of years, they will find a way to negate. So we won't even have the protection that's claimed to be there for a five-year period. These are bad agreements. These are agreements that are going to allow Korean manufacturers to draw parts from China, fill their cars with them, and send them to the United States with impunity. You know, these are not things that the American public knows about in any kind of detail and has been paying attention to. But on a overall scale, we've done polling with AAM that clearly shows the American public gets it, that these are not good for America. Not, you know, and they're part of the problem.
So, and, you know, going back to what you said earlier, and again, I don't want to vilify the president either. I don't want to beat him up where he doesn't deserve it. But, you know, you look at these agreements, and again, I don't see how they're good for us. And, you know, I'm not seeing the strong labor protections that we were promised, given the what's going on in Colombia.
Yeah, and, you know, the steelworkers have a very strong statement, you know, and have been very clear that they're not in agreement with these trade agreements. That they need to come back, they need to be renegotiated, and there just needs to be a totally redesigned relationship. The other thing is, you're just on the face of it. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, some sort of economics expert to understand, you know, that if you take a certain type of economy and you allow it to trade freely with our economy, and those economies don't operate on the same principles, you can't in any way, shape, or form do anything but lose jobs out of that.
Yep.
And that's what we're doing with Korea. That's what we're doing with China. You know, we're just conceding to a race to the bottom that we know the answer before we start, and yet we lie about it, and our politicians lie about it. And that just has to stop. And that's a feature of, you know, if you really want to look at it, the fact that our Congress has sold out on this issue for so long, and people have to hold them accountable and have to bring them back in line on that.
Last question I've got for you. Do you see this occupation movement, which is really very at the very beginning? I don't think anybody knows where this is going to lead, but do you think this is something that maybe that movement will put pressure on?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, people have said they don't know what they're for. That doesn't matter. They're in the right place. You know, they're on Wall Street. They're at the heart of the problem. And the Wall Street folks can't hide behind D.C. at this point. You know, they're exposed. They're there. They have to answer for what they're doing. And we've cut out the middleman in this little game we've been playing about destroying the American economy. And so, yeah, I applaud what they're doing. I think that they're a breath of fresh air. I think their movement is growing because it makes sense to people. And I think in the end, the solutions are there. People know what the solutions are. You just got to have the political will. And, you know, sitting up there in New York as long as they have and now spreading across the country. I was in Harrisburg today. There's a couple folks sitting at the bottom of the Capitol steps that we're occupying.
And they're going to be the big occupation is going to take place, Saturday is when the big numbers are going to come out here in Harrisburg. And we were in Philadelphia. They had some 3,000 people out there.
And it's not just going to be weekend events. These are going to be growing tent cities, growing populations. In Boston, the police move real aggressively. So there's going to be that kind of thing going on, until this gets resolved. And that's what Wall Street's bringing on us. That's what these trade agreements are bringing on us. That's what the politicians in D.C. are bringing on us, because people are frustrated, and they are not going to allow this country to become a third world nation.
And that is what it's about. Ike Getlin, Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My cases are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I got an email from Andy pointing out the the CNN article that, you know, again, the job czar and his crew came up with. And, you know, their idea, again, the business idea of creating jobs is basically, you know, stripping all regulation, you know, handing out more money to the big corporations. You know, we need more job training programs to match the workers with the vacancy. So we need to retool that old thing. And the big one, the crown jewel, American corporations need to be allowed to bring in more high skilled immigrant labor to fill the jobs that, you know, Americans just can't do. Think about that statement and what it means about education in this country. We need to go outside this country. Stop and think about this, Republicans. Stop and think about this, flag wavers and chest thumpers and finger wavers. The jobs are, the business community is saying that you are incapable of filling their needs. So they need to go outside the country to bring people in, and we need to make that process just slippery smooth. I think it's kind of nuts. And you look at these trade agreements, more insanity. And look, I don't want to beat up on the president any more than I have to. But when you're wrong, you're wrong. And I go back to Wyden, and I like Ron Wyden. Like him a lot. I think he's a good guy. But this whole analogy, this whole situation that he's using, that, you know, when we ship beef from Oregon to South Korea, they charge us 40%. But when we ship it back, when they ship beef from South Korea to the U.S., we only charge them 4%. One, why in the hell are you trading beef? That's a consumption item local. Why are we shipping it halfway across the world? And two, why would you let them bring stuff in if you don't have that reciprocal agreement anyway? You don't need a free trade agreement to say, okay, well, we'll trade on equal ground. You charge me 40%, I'm going to raise mine up to 40%. Doesn't that make sense on some level? No, yes, maybe. I mean, this whole idea that we need to lower everything down to the bottom so that corporate America can make their big profits and put all of us at each other's throats is just nonsense. But that's where we're going, folks. That's where we're going. Anyway, thanks for the email, Andy, and you're right. Sometimes it is hard to hold back the vomit. Thanks so much. Again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Lee Fong from Think Progress, he's going to be here talking about the Eric Erickson and his We Are the 53% site. You know, guy making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year whining. We're back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American standard of living is in decline as household income for working families continues to fall. According to the Census Bureau, inflation-adjusted median household income fell 9.8% from the start of the Bush Great Recession through June of 2011. The report on household income by Census Bureau officials Gordon W. Green Jr. and John F. Coder said this household income decline is a significant reduction in the American standard of living. So our economic system not only is failing to create nearly enough jobs for us, those of us who still have jobs are watching our income go down in what is supposed to be an economic recovery. Princeton economic professor Henry S. Farber also found that workers who found work again after losing their jobs made an average of 17.5% less in their new jobs. As the United Auto Workers Union worked Monday to reach a deal with Chrysler on a new four-year labor contract, UAW leaders called local bargaining units to a Detroit meeting. Chrysler is complaining that the GM and Ford deals are too rich, despite the fact that those deals increased labor costs by just 1%. at GM and Ford. Both the UAW and Chrysler say they want to reach a negotiated deal and not go to arbitration. Arbitration must take into consideration the compensation for workers at foreign plants operating in the U.S. UAW total compensation is still higher than those plants. The contract for 23,000 UAW workers at Chrysler expired September 14th. Honeywell workers in Kansas City are on strike. Jesse Russell has more.
2 months ago, United Steelworkers ratified a 3-year contract agreement with Honeywell International's uranium processing facility in Metropolis. That agreement ended a 13-month-long lockout of workers at the plant. Honeywell is now facing a strike at a Kansas City plant, with workers putting down their tools on Sunday. The most recent contract offer was rejected by 79% of voting employees, and 85% voted to strike. The employees are represented by the International Association of Machinists, who issued a statement saying the company is negotiating in bad faith over a 3-year contract. The machinists plan to file unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board. The union has declined to reveal the allegations due to the NLRB being closed Monday for a federal holiday.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a 1-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Well, you know, you listen to the Glenn Becks long enough, and I still can't get it out of my head. Violent hippies. That's the phrase of the day, the Beck phrase of the day. It's all those violent hippies. The violent hippies are taking over the country, and they want to destroy America. They hate America. Man. That guy, at one point, I actually thought he was funny for a while. He has completely flipped his lid way off the deep end. Somebody bring him back to the path, because he's really gone. We need some white coats very soon. Anyway, but there's this whole, you know, we're trying to, the right is really trying to figure out how to attack what's going on in all these occupations. And, you know, none better than this Eric Erickson, who has started this We Are the 53% site. Again, you know, another joke. But here to talk to us about it is our good friend Lee Fong from Think Progress. Lee, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me again.
You know, I look at this guy, you know, doing his little We Are the 53%, and, you know, I work 3 jobs, and I have a house I can't sell, and blah, 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 and I'm all this misery. Yet here's a guy making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Oh, boy, to have those problems.
Well, you know, what Eric Erickson is trying to do is basically play the victim card. He wants people to feel sorry for him. He posted this kind of sarcastic, but semi-serious, posting to kick off the satire of the 99% movement, saying that he's part of the 53% of people who pay their income taxes and has to struggle. And he says he has 3 jobs and a house he can't sell. He's barely getting by. He's not blaming Wall Street like all those hippies up in New York. 2 things. The first thing, the income tax assertion is completely deceptive. Right. Yes, only 53% of Americans pay the income tax, but every American pays taxes in the form of payroll taxes, sales taxes, fees, and a litany of other taxes. So that's silly. But the bigger kind of point that we raised at Think Progress was that this is a guy who's a very wealthy media pundit. He's got a plush gig at CNN. He has a well-paid job on the radio. He's employed by a multi-million-dollar media company called Eagle Publishing. And here he is begging for sympathy.
And what I find ironic about it is he's basically just a shill for, you know, for big business. I mean, especially the banking industry, which is, again, you know, they treat their people pretty well.
Well, I think you hit the nail around the head earlier when you mentioned that the right hasn't figured out a good vilification strategy yet. You know, I saw a clip on Fox that was really similar to the Beck thing you mentioned. They were calling the Occupy Wall Street protesters fascists in the same sentence that they were describing their drum circles. So I don't know if the Nazis had drum circles, but you know they haven't decided. And I think the true kind of cynicism here is that a lot of the people out there are just doing their best to try to diminish and marginalize the really brave people who are out occupying these different cities. The irony is they're paid by big business. You know, Eric Erickson has admitted to Bloomberg News that bank lobbyists approached him and helped him write these blog posts attacking what's called the Durbin Amendment. So, you know, he's hand in glove with these bank lobbyists, and I think that explains partially why he's doing this kind of cheap gimmick.
You know, but looking at the folks who have taken to the streets, and I've been advocating this for several years now, that, you know, people need to get out and say, look, I'm angry, I'm frustrated. And I said early on when the Tea Party first started, when that first group began, I could identify with them. I was angry. I was ticked off, too, only they took some bizarre rightward turn. But I understand the anger. And being out in Philadelphia and being out to some of the meetings here in Harrisburg, you get the sense that people are angry and they're frustrated and they're looking for something else, because what's going on right now, it's not working for the vast majority of the people in the country. And I think that scares the hell out of the corporate elites and the billionaire class in this country.
Here's what scares them the most, Rick. You know, I felt the same way. I liked the beginning of the Tea Party. I liked people getting upset at serious issues, because the financial crisis was very serious. The difference between the Tea Party that we've seen in the last 2 years and what's growing in just the last 3 weeks is that the Tea Party, as it began, corporate front groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, they went out and they captured people by installing speakers at different events, putting people on listservs that they controlled, and then they would send out their talking points. The Occupy Wall Street 99% movement is the exact opposite. Yes, there's that same passion and rage at really substantive issues, but the difference is it's not a one-dimensional form of communication. People are getting in general assemblies, debating, passing on different types of information, talking about different aspects of the economy and different problems that we're all facing. It's a real discourse that's going on all over America, and that's what they really hate.
Yeah, you know, we went to the first day of the Occupy Philly, and, you know, there was, I think, 3,000-4,000 people there. And just what you were saying, they were having, you know, excruciatingly painful conversations because of the slow pace. But that's when you're talking about Athenian-type democracy, that's what happens. But they were trying diligently to work through this, and you have to give them credit for that. Out of all the some 4,000 people who were there, the local talk radio that I heard focused on one guy. There was one transgender guy walking around with a sign, not bothering anybody, just saying, I got fired for being transgender. And talk radio in Philadelphia there, that's all they focused on, was this one guy. So the whole movement of people there, evidently in their mind, was about this one guy.
They don't want to argue the facts. They don't want to talk about rising inequality. They don't want to talk about the fact that the banks that destroyed the economy, none of them have been prosecuted. No one's gone to jail. They don't want to talk about the rising cost of food because of commodity speculation that the banks engage in, or a lot of these failed privatization schemes in prisons and other places. All they have, basically, are these authoritarian tactics. They'll take some minority group, in this case a transgendered person, or maybe it's some ethnic minority, like a Muslim, and they'll vilify and vilify and vilify and say, that person's a freak, they're not a real American, these people aren't normal. I mean, those are authoritarian tactics, and that's all they have because they don't want to talk about the substance.
Yeah, and I look at I've been trying. You know, my friends keep telling me I've got to hear what the other side is saying, and I have to listen to the Glenn Becks of the world and all of these. And I feel myself getting crazier the more I listen to them. Going, I can't believe there are actually people who think that way. But he's on like 300 different stations, which is just remarkable to me.
Well, the good thing is, since Beck was kicked to the curb by Fox News a couple months ago, his audience is much smaller. And, you know, I think a lot of people are turning away from Fox News and some of the other right-wing outlets. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, corporations and their basic right-wing puppets like Glenn Beck and some of these other folks, they've got a big microphone. They control an inordinate amount of speakers, if you will. They've got radio, cable news, and, you know, multi-million and in some cases multi-billion-dollar lobbyists, public relations agencies, and groups that can put ads on television. So this is an uphill battle just to get information out there and to get an accurate read on what's really going on.
And they've got enough money to fill the pockets of a shill like Eric Erickson, and to get you know, this kind of a start and give him some kind of credibility. Because there were several other people on his site who, you know, who followed that frame, this Horatio Alger version of themselves. And, you know, I've said it before, I could easily be one of those people. You know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. I have done pretty well. I could easily say, you know what, I was of such moral fiber and intestinal fortitude that I lifted myself up. But that's not reality. But that's the frame that they're pushing. And you know, from the right's view, you know, why get rid of a good frame, even if it is wrong?
Well, look, I sympathize with it, too. I mean, it's part of the American dream and a little bit of the American fantasy. I mean, my parents, my father came here from China, didn't speak any English, had a few dollars in his pocket. Worked as a dishwasher, moved his way up, and helped provide for me and my family. But he didn't get there on his own. You know, he went to community colleges that are funded by all the rest of us. He used public resources like roads and other types of infrastructure. I mean, you have to tell a much larger and more holistic story, and then you really get to to where we all agree, because you know Eric Erickson, you know, he pretends that you know he doesn't need the government, he doesn't need anyone, and that he got everything on his own, kind of like you said, intestinal fortitude. But we know that's a myth. He benefited from the same public goods that almost everyone else has.
Well, like the internet, you mean, with his Red State website?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Lastly, last question I've got for you. One of the things that I've been surprised that we're seeing is it coming out that the, you know, like in Wisconsin when we were there, the Koch brother, I forget which one, made the call to Walker and said, hey, you want me to send in some troublemakers? We've seen some troublemakers pop up, and they've actually been outed, and I'm pretty surprised at that.
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to this amazing story last weekend. When a splinter group from Occupy DC went to protest the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum because they have this exhibit glorifying military drones, in my opinion, a legitimate issue. Anyways, they came to the museum. Yeah, and just a small group of the protesters rushed the door, were pepper sprayed. Only one or two people were actually pepper sprayed, I believe, or a small handful. But one of the people weren't actually an authentic protester. One of them was from the American Spectator, the right-wing magazine that was funded by a guy up in your area, Rick, Richard Mellon Scaife, to go after Clinton. Now the same magazine has their reporter acting as a plant, and in his own words, saying he's trying to undermine the movement.
And what I liked is the response after getting pepper sprayed, that the cop who pepper sprayed me was braver than those left-wingers who wouldn't march in here with me. No, they were smarter than you, dum-dum.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are the dirty tricks, and we just have to be vigilant. We don't have to be paranoid like Glenn Beck, but people need to be vigilant. I mean, there's a reason that Peter Thiel, a billionaire who got rich from PayPal, gave a big block of money to James O'Keefe back in the day to go after Acorn. They know that these tactics work because look what happened to Acorn.
Yep.
And we'll see more of it. We have to be vigilant.
Yeah, you're spot on. The whole Acorn thing. And you try to explain people that the fraud in all that was not Acorn's doing. Acorn was the organization that was defrauded.
But exactly.
That goes over.
You know, again, the corporate media doesn't report it, so.
That goes over to the majority of folks' heads. But I appreciate the work you guys do over there at the Think Progress blog. Great stuff, and the work that you do too, Lee. I appreciate your time, man.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good night, Rick.
You too. Our good friend Lee Fong from Think Progress. Going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
As Ray Charles sang years ago, them that's got is them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. A majority of Americans are now seeing that them that's got are not only getting theirs, but also getting ours. The wealthiest 1% of Americans possess more net worth today than the bottom 90% of us combined. Worse, these privileged few and their political henchmen have structured a new economic normal of long-term joblessness, low wages, miserly public services, and a steadily widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us. This is the alienating reality that Occupy Wall Street has chosen to confront. This burgeoning movement began in September when about a dozen college students pitched camp in Liberty Plaza in the heart of New York's financial district and began daily peaceful marches down Wall Street. This is not your grandfather's tightly organized protest. It's intentionally loose. Instead of a leader, group decisions are reached through a consensus-based democratic process. With no faith in traditional politics or conventional media, the mostly young protesters have taken to the streets, using their well-honed culture of the web to organize, strategize, harmonize, and mobilize. Their encampment might look chaotic at first, but look again. It includes a medical clinic, media center, cafeteria, and library. Food? Their widely viewed website lets anyone in the world go online and have pizzas delivered to them from a local shop. They even produce their own newspaper, appropriately named the Occupied Wall Street Journal. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York protest is growing, and the movement has now spread to more than 50 cities, from major hubs like Chicago to such smaller places as McAllen, Texas. All across the USA, something is happening here. Link into it at www.occupytogether.com.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, comments, questions, something on your mind. You can also email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Also, if you missed any portion of our program, you can go to the website and download our podcast. Also, if you got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take your program on the go. So, I was looking through the USA Today. Useless Today had a story about the shrinking of the Army. Evidently, there is a growing percentage of soldiers who are now considered medically unfit. They're saying there was a conference on Monday in D.C. that said about 15% of active forces aren't deployable for medical reasons. The lieutenant general who was there, a guy named Eric Shoemaker, was reported saying that, look, you know, you got these people just not fit for duty. He called that a growing problem has been this is eroding our readiness of the Army as a whole. And he said that many of those involved are not injured in combat. You know, you've got a whole bunch of other problems, you know, PTSD, a whole bunch of stuff. This other guy, Major General Richard Stone, he's the Deputy Surgeon General. He said that 25% of recruits coming into the service have low iron and low bone density, and that recruits overall have a higher body mass index. In fact, the highest level ever recorded. So on one level, you're going, we got kids with soft bones and big bodies. And that's a problem. So now this Lieutenant General Eric Shoemaker is saying, look, commanders at the medical centers across the country, start examining this. Start looking at people's body mass index, looking at the communities, look at children, look at family members, start maybe figuring out how we're going to bring people into the military. And it kind of took me back to the school lunch programs, really the milk program before World War II, where you know, you had people who were malnourished and we had to get them nourishment. So they went through the schools and started these milk programs and then lunch programs and then eventually breakfast programs so that you could have people ready to fight. So I was watching C-SPAN today and I'm looking for the talk on trade, and I'm looking for the currency debates, and I come across this guy talking about school lunch programs. And somebody called in and said, we spend too much money on school lunch programs. Parents should have to pay for it. I'm going, well, what about like when I was a kid? That meal that the kids got at the local school through the lunch program was really the only hot meal they got, and it was the mass of the calories they got for the day. Pretty interesting. But we've gone from a society where kids are malnourished to now they're overweight. And I think a big part of this, and again, I'm calling on my Republican friends, my family values friends, to look at the economy, because we live in a fast food nation. Myself to blame as well, but my kids don't. Because my wife stays home with them. My wife cooks for them every night. My wife is there for them. And the problem is we have an economy based on two parents working just to survive. That's a problem. We have an economy based on the lowest wage possible. So what you end up with is you end up with families who are struggling, and they end up on the welfare diet. And I'm a product of that welfare diet. I don't like it, but it's reality. Which is basically spaghetti, macaroni, and cheese. You throw a noodle in with something, that's the welfare diet. The cheapest possible food that's going to fill your stomach and not cost you as much. It's cheap. And it fills bellies. You don't have to look at hungry kids in the eyes. And, you know, I'll be honest, I remember as a kid going to the cabinet. Don't look like it now, but I remember when I was a kid going to the cabinets, and there being nothing there. Literally nothing. Now, that's hard for us to, a lot of people to fathom. And my kids, fortunately, they have, in fact, my refrigerator is so packed, I can't get stuff out of it. And that's, I guess, a good thing on one hand. You know, my wife keeps everything fairly well stocked. She knows where it is. I, on the other hand, do not. But, you know, going from one extreme where there's nothing in there to where I can't get anything out, that's, you know, and again, I can say, you know what, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Look at me. Went from empty fridge to can't get anything out fridge. And the right wing would, yes, you are right, Mr. Smith. You are the Horatio Alger of our day. Nonsense. Absolute, utter nonsense.
Could it be that your wife is hiding the rich foods in the back?
No, you know, and here's the thing, and this is where I got to give my wife all the credit in the world, and I know she's not listening, so this is not a suck up.
So it's safe.
My wife has done what I'm sure my mother would have loved to have been able to do had she the resources to do it, which is to expose the children to every vegetable, fruit, every good thing that they could possibly, every nutritious thing that they could possibly intake, she has exposed them to and made them consume to the point where they like it. In fact, last year, and again, I'm not, you know, not sucking up here, but, and this is credit to my wife, when at school they asked all the kids in the class, you know, what their favorite food was, my daughter actually, and I don't know if I should be happy about this or feel sorry for her, but she said broccoli was actually her favorite food. I'm going, really? Broccoli? Yeah.
Broccoli's good. It's made right.
Yeah, but you're talking about an 8-year-old going, I'd rather have broccoli over candy.
Now, you know, maybe you can go halfway. You mix that with noodles. That's not bad either. Vegetables and noodles. That's not a bad meal.
So it's only half of the welfare diet is what you're saying.
I'm saying it's halfway. For me, that would be a good meal, from a taste perspective.
There you go.
Now, I don't know if you guys mix noodles with it, but I knowing your wife, probably not.
No, she's not so much. Again, you know, and fortunately, they're probably not going to have some of the problems that we're seeing going through the military. And it's, you know, going back to this, it's something that they're going to have to deal with. Much like, you know, back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, you were worried about kids not having enough meat on their bones, and now got a little bit too much. Now they're saying that, you know, what we'll kick out of them during boot camp. We'll straighten them out. We'll slim them down. But they're saying, you know, and this is where you're probably going to see more military involvement in schools, which, you know, unfortunately may be where the funding comes from. Since we've got a governor who seems hell-bent on cutting funding everywhere he possibly can. In fact, he rolled out his voucher plan. And again, you know, I'm looking at this, I'm going, you know, is this the time we're gonna be pushing a voucher plan? He was in York this afternoon calling for, you know, his voucher plan. Gotta have school choice. See, there are schools in the state and they're not performing well. So they need to have some opportunity. So we're gonna set up some of those there charter schools, and we're gonna let the businesses do more through the tax credits. It's good stuff. Gonna contribute to private schools, basically destroying the public school system. He's also said that he wants some new teacher evaluations, some new administrative evaluations, you know, to kind of look at, you know, your classroom performance and your observation stuff. So basically putting more responsibility on the teacher to worry about what's going on at home as well. Now, what I find amazing is the guy Corbett cut a whole boatload of money from the public education system. A boatload. And now he's going to hand out another boatload to a privatization scheme. That money is going to come from somewhere. And understand, folks, when you get your property tax bill, start thinking about this. Because when your property taxes keep going up and up and up and up, you're going to know that, thank you, privatization has worked. Because privatization is going to do exactly what it's supposed to do. Destroy what is public and cost you a boatload of money so that they can profit with it. So, yeah, there are some schools that are failing. But you know what? This is not going to fix that problem. Because we're not even beginning to consider how to fix the problems that we have with the schools that are so-called failing. And again, you know, as we talked about earlier with Robert Applebaum, you know, we're in a system where it's about the profit. Education in this country should be about training critical thinkers, teaching people how to think, teaching people to solve problems, not put out little vessels of little miniature workers. You know, I think we just have this all backwards. But here again, we're going to have this conversation, and over the next couple of days, we're going to get some folks from the education sector to come talk to us. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? I personally think it is a bad thing. And this is what the governor wants to push forth. We want more accountability for teachers, and we want no real accountability for the vouchers. I'm completely mind blown. And I look at the press release from the people at the NFIB, this independent business organization. You gotta love it. They said, you know what? The public school system is designed on a 19th century model and needs to be modernized. I don't know why we can't do that and keep it public, but okay, if that's what you say there, Kevin. He says small business owners compete every day to succeed in the private marketplace. Don't know what small business has to do with education, but okay. Competition drives productivity and innovation. Without this key element, complacency sets in and productivity drops. Again, going to this industrial mindset, but he's saying, you know what? Education is a 19th century model right now, yet all he keeps talking about is the industrial model. Kind of funny. He says the worst performing school districts are not failing because we don't spend enough money on them. In fact, we spend more money on them than all others. We can't allow those children in those schools to remain as prisoners. Really? So where are you going to send them? to that private school that's a prison? I'm just not getting it, Kevin. And I think we need to talk to him. I think we need to get Kevin on the program and get this whole prison thing straightened out. Nuts. Just nuts. But again, he knows. He knows that once they get their foot in the door, they get their hand out, they get their snout in the trough, man, it's... They're going to suck it up. And you and I are going to pay the bill, and our children, well, we're going to suffer. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep, and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a Senior Blue PPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal, and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can over the telephone, and it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So a couple people arrested at the Capitol today?
Six arrested at the Capitol today, yes. They went to the Hart Senate office building, 100 protesters shouting, "We are the 99%, tax the rich, end the war," and with banners saying, "End the war and cure electoral dysfunction." And the Capitol Police didn't take too kindly to it. And one man actually got into an elevator, pressed all the buttons, trying to render it unusable. As saying, we're occupying this state, we're occupying D.C., the idea is to shut it down. Now, the thing is, what is interesting is that they were not actually a representative of Occupy D.C. They were from separate organizations, so this was not organized by the group that's basically organizing Occupy D.C.
So could this be a right-wing plant, as we've seen coming out? Could this be someone trying to cause some trouble for those folks?
No, this was not the American Spectator or right-wing plants. This was a bunch of left-wing plants run amok and trying to take their message to the Hart Senate office building.
Just another bunch of dum-dums.
Yeah.
Again, we were talking about this earlier. The reality is what frightens me is that as the numbers dwindle, it'll only be those crazy people who are left.
Well, this is the risk. I mean, the risk is that this could go wrong, and the other risk is that it could get co-opted by anarchists. And the hope is that it stays peaceful, and nobody knows which way it's going to go. But if you keep on getting agents provocateurs, which as you've been getting from right-wing so-called journalists, getting into the protests and trying to influence things, then almost anything can happen.
Yeah, I always go back to the Jay Gould quote. I use it early, I use it often. I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. The good robber baron, railroad magnate of the late 1800s. And just as true then as it is now.
Well, interestingly, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor today backed off from his contention that Occupy Wall Street protesters are a mob, which, if you remember, he said just a couple of days ago, "I, for one, am increasingly concerned about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street and the other cities across the country." And he's now saying that that's not exactly what he was saying. What I was attempting to say is that the action and statements of leaders, elected leaders in this town, condoning the pitting of Americans against Americans is not very helpful right now, which actually is not what he said at all.
Yeah, no, it isn't. But, you know, again, it's always nice to be able to go back and rewrite history a little bit. And I love Mitt Romney came out and he said that, well, you know, he's worried about the 99% in America. As were, you know, not too long ago, he said, well, he thinks it's dangerous, this class war thing.
Mitt Romney actually said that he was worried about the 99% in America on the same day and just a few hours after he said that the 99% in America were dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable indeed. But again, you know, what do you expect? So other news going on in New York, the Times is suing the Justice Department. Is that true?
This is very interesting. New York Times and reporter Charlie Savage are plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Department of Justice over the release of a secret government interpretation of the Patriot Act. What it is that Savage reported in May, back then, Senators Mark Udall and Ron Wyden referenced secret elements to the Patriot Act and offered an amendment to make public the details that had previously been withheld, because the Senate at the time was voting on a reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which was reauthorized. And they said, look, there's one version of the Patriot Act presented to the public, and there's another version of the Patriot Act that's withheld by the government. And they proposed making the secret version public. Wyden said the following, I want to deliver a warning this afternoon. When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry. And Savage wrote about it. And so then Savage filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests and appeals to justice wanting the government's interpretation of the Patriot Act. Well, got nothing. So now they've sued.
Well, and look, I mean, how are you supposed to follow the law if you don't know what the law is? How are you supposed to know what it is if they're not telling you? And this is, again, another one of those instances where the anti-government people, the people who want to destroy our government, have a valid point. They're being secretive. They're hiding something. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you could point to, and you can't argue with that.
No, it'll be very interesting to see if indeed this secret version of the Patriot Act exists.
I'm sure it does, and I'm sure it's nothing we're going to be happy with, and probably all of the conspiracy theory that's out there is probably pretty close to being true of people, of the government breaking into your house and putting spyware on your computer or whatever in your house to keep an eye on you. I've heard all the stories.
We all have, and of course Jerry Brown has just vetoed a bill that would have stopped the police from being able to search your cell phone.
Well, there's a step in the right direction. On the presidential note, looks like Chris Christie's thrown his name back out into the fray, only this time an endorsement.
Yes, Chris Christie has gone ahead and endorsed Mitt Romney. He did that ahead of the debate today, saying Mitt Romney is the man we need to lead America, and saying that he was fully behind him. And Mitt Romney in turn called Chris Christie a real hero in Republican circles. So he was very enthusiastic about him, and really very gung-ho about Mitt Romney. He had a press conference and basically said that he was the one who could beat Obama and the one who should beat Obama, saying that we can't stand another 4 years of Obama. We basically won't survive another 4 years of Obama. And Christie and Romney are in many ways an odd couple because they're so different in style.
Right.
But in some ways, it does make sense because they've seen the practical challenges of trying to match ideology with governing. And in some ways, they've succeeded at it, and in some ways, they've failed at it. What this is really for Romney is potentially a jackpot financially. This is what this is really all about.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I mean,
Christie was poised to get a lot of money.
Yeah, all that money. And if he, because when I first saw it, I go, there's your VP right there. He's going to bring a ton of cash. I think that if Romney gets it, he's the guy, I think.
Yeah, I think that's possibly the case. And that's why the big Northeast Republican money is all really following this Republican debate tonight up at Dartmouth very, very carefully to see whether Rick Perry can really redeem himself before they make that big decision of where their money's going to go. I mean, they're not all going to decide tonight, but they're really coming close to the wire now.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're going to study his campaign for generations, I think, because he came out with you know, basically everything he could want. He had a lot of money. He had a lot of enthusiasm. There was a lot involved there, and he has done nothing but walk off the edge of a cliff.
Well, he just hasn't been able to get it together, and what he hasn't been able to do is to overcome being a Texas politician, and that's something that George W. Bush was able to do. He was able to transfer from being a Texas politician to being a national politician, and I think part of the reason he was able to do that was being his father's son.
Right. So the debate this evening, a sit-down affair, a nice round table. It was kind of interesting to watch.
Oval table, correct. It's an oval table, yes. They're not Knights of the Round Table. And they're being seated according to their ranking in the polls. So you've got Mitt Romney with the prime position. Then you've got Herman Cain next to him. And then further down the table is Rick Perry, and he's paired with Ron Paul. And then way out, you know, right
Rick
in the hinterland is Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann, yeah.
Where they belong, out on the fringe. So it's kind of like racing then. Romney's got the pole position. Might as well make politics, you know, what it's turned into, a race of some sort. So there you go. Very nice. Lastly, the jobs bill went down, blocked in the Senate, as we knew, as I think everyone knew it was going to be.
Everybody knew it was going to be. It really was going to be the question of how many Democrats would vote for it. And they got 50, probably 51. They didn't get Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who had said he would filibuster. And they didn't get John Tester of Montana, who has a tough re-election coming up and who decided, I think, that, well, I'd really like to keep my job more than I'd like to vote for this. Senator Gene Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, had to be somewhere to receive an award, so she wasn't there. Right. So they held up the vote for her to come back to vote. So they'll probably get her, but that's it. They did get everybody except for Nelson and Tester, which wasn't bad, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah, you're not going to get to the 60. What I found interesting, and I was listening to some of the discussion today, Ron Wyden brought it up from Oregon. He was talking about these trade agreements. Moving on to the trade agreements, he was, and this is just one of these things that's been stuck with me ever since. He said that in Oregon they send off beef to South Korea, and it faces a 40% tariff when the beef gets to Korea. But when South Korea sends beef to the U.S., they get a 4% tariff. And my first thought is, and I don't think I've heard anybody saying it, why in the hell are we trading beef with South Korea if they're producing their own? Why don't you keep it at home? And that's not something you should be trading, or am I just missing something here?
No, I don't think you're missing something at all.
I mean, it makes absolutely no sense, and it's really a dumb argument, even from the Democrats, especially,
yeah.
Since they should know better. These trade agreements have done nothing, and this jobs bill, you know, with the trade agreements in it as well, I questioned from the beginning. Anyway, Victoria, always great to talk to you, and always great to rant at you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Have a great night.
You too.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. A report on the super committee that was set up by the president coming out of the Alliance for Retired Americans. According to sources on the Hill, members of Congress on this super committee that are charged with reducing the nation's budget deficit are considering changing the formula that determines the cost of living for future Social Security recipients. COLAs currently are tied to the Consumer Price Index for urban wage earners, which surveys price changes in the average set of goods purchased by urban wage earners and clerical workers. There have been no COLA increases in the last 2 years. Yet many in Congress are seriously considering cutting Social Security benefits by now tying the COLA to the changed CPI, CPIU, and even smaller measure of inflation. The changed CPI assumes that a lower COLA is acceptable because consumers can substitute cheaper products when the prices go up. The problem is that the health care costs, which consume a large amount of seniors' income, cannot simply be substituted with the cheaper version. What they're talking about is if someone needs an operation on a knee. You can't substitute that with a cane. You can't substitute certain medicines with a cheaper medicine. In essence, the super committee is relying on the ability of seniors to, for lack of a better word, buy on the cheap to make up for the money that they want to save. And obviously, that's the wrong way to go. Now, correlating issue here is Romney, who has been attacking the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. Rick Perry obviously made a stupid comment about Social Security being a Ponzi scheme. And Romney said, no, I disagree with that. It's not a Ponzi scheme. However, before we anoint him as the protector of the Social Security system, we got to look at what he's actually proposed. And Mr. Romney is not only proposing that you wait longer for Social Security, but he's actually proposing a smaller cost of living increase. So it seems like all the Republicans, including Mr. Romney, who in some issues tries to appear to be moving towards the middle, all of the Republicans, every one of them, if they are elected, will go after Social Security. You can bet on that. The Harrisburg situation, Rick, again, coming out of the Harrisburg Patriot, and this situation goes on and on and on. There was a survey conducted by ABC 27 News that was conducted by Susquehanna Polling and Research, and they asked a total of 1,000 people their opinion on whether the council and the mayor should get together or whether they should allow the state to come in and take over. And this was the conclusion from that polling. 53% said the council and Thompson should reach an agreement. 24% said the state should take over the city. 13% said Harrisburg should seek bankruptcy. And 10% said they should not seek any of these three options, which I'm not sure that means anything. Corollary issue, Rick, 4 council members have come out and they've issued a statement. They have twice refused to get on board with the mayor's proposal, the 247 plan. This is what they said in a news release to the public. The duty is to the people on Wall Street. The duty is to the people on Walnut Street, which is one of the streets in Harrisburg, not Wall Street. What they're referring to is what they don't like. The bond company that did their insuring for the one of the projects, which has about a $310 million bill for the city. I'm talking about the incinerator. These council members feel that they aren't giving back enough. There's not enough concessions coming from them. They're also disappointed that those on the Hill will not allow them to enact the 1% sales tax. That is their proposal. Robert Fillman, who's a spokesman for the mayor, has come out and said, look, you guys are going to have to be more pragmatic. You're going to have to face reality. They are not going to do that. We have to sit together. You need to sit down with the mayor. So in response to that, two of the council members, Brown Wilson and Williams, plan to meet with the mayor. The mayor has repeatedly said, and she's accurate, if they don't agree to this plan, the state will come over and they will take over, and basically the mayor and the city council will be pretty much powerless. And if that happens, that's nothing but bad things for the city. Back to you, Rick.
Well, in talking about the Harrisburg City Council issue, they've voted this evening 4-3 they're going to go after Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy. You kind of wonder about this, but, you know, that's the path they're going to take.
Well, it's pick your poison time.
Yeah, so we'll see where this takes us. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. Stick around. We'll be right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strikebreakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, you good workers, good news to you out there. Hurrah, oh, the good old union has come in here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there from the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go with you. Have it with you anytime, anywhere, thanks to the folks over at Stitcher. You know, look, at the end of this, I'm looking at this story about the vote this evening here in Harrisburg. The city council did vote 4-3 to file bankruptcy protection, the Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy protection. And, you know, I think, you know, as you, Brad Kaplinski said, you know, look, the stakeholders haven't come to the table. They haven't negotiated in good faith. The creditors haven't done it either. So is this a carrot and stick scenario, or we're going to threaten you with the stick so maybe they come to the table? I don't know. But this attorney that they hired this evening, I was looking at his charges. I think his name is Schwartz, Mark Schwartz. He normally charges $525 an hour. I'm sure there are people in the oldest profession in the world going, "I don't even get $520, $25 an hour." But just for the council, he has reduced his fee down to $300 an hour. That's mighty good of him.
What a guy. Unless
the city wins a substantial concession. So again, this kind of setting up for me, they're gonna look at, they're gonna push this idea out there. But I don't know that, you know, bankruptcy is the right option. We will see as this plays out. Another interesting story coming out. The Washington Post is reporting that, a new book is coming out from the retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. And in his new book, well, he kind of takes a swipe at George W. Bush, saying that his legal team, and I wonder how this would work in the Texas tort reform world. Stevens says that the Bush team made a frivolous application when it asked the Supreme Court to intervene and stop the Florida recount. And, you know, I said that for a while. I don't know why the court got in the middle of it. It wasn't done yet. The process hadn't worked its way out. But Stevens going, hey, you know, this is a frivolous deal. But he didn't, he didn't have the ability to stop it. It was a 5-4 decision, like many of the right-wing decisions. Of the day, it was Anthony Kennedy, the most powerful man in the country right now, Sandra Day O'Connor, William Rehnquist, Anton Scalia, and, of course, Clarence Thomas, all voting in support of George Bush. And, of course, Breyer, Ginsburg, Souter, and Stevens in the opposition. I look at this, and I got to be honest. You know, why weren't you out there saying this before there, JP? The new book is Five Chiefs, a Supreme Court memoir. It is due out fairly soon, I guess. So I don't buy many books. Most of the time we get, you know, people send us books for interviews and stuff. I may actually go out and buy this guy's book just to see what he thinks of what's going on with the Supreme Court today. Because it can't be, and he was a fairly conservative justice. I mean, he was, a fairly conservative guy. You kind of got to wonder. Interesting story from our friends over at the False Claims Act website. How many people have heard of Oracle, the big corporation? Well, they've agreed to pay $200 million because of price gouging and failing to meet their contractual obligations to the General Services Administration, the GSA. This is the largest False Claims Act settlement that the GSA has ever obtained. Among the top 30 False Claims Act cases of all time, and the second time Oracle has been nailed under the False Claims Act. In 2008, they paid nearly $100 million for basically the same fraud. Now, this is the kind of stuff that drives me nuts. You know, we hear the radical right wing saying, well, you know, we gotta go after the waste, fraud, and abuse. We've got to go after the Office of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. Why isn't there a commission? And this is where you go to the folks, you know, down in Wall Street there, the Occupy Wall Street movement there, and you look at some of the tenets of the things that they're kind of pushing for. They had, seven of them? Seven demands, if you will. And when I hear people go, well, I don't know why they're there. Seven reasons. Pretty clear. And I've talked about them this week. One of them, intense regulation of the defense industry. Intense regulation of our procurement. So that Oracle, back in 2008 when they got popped for screwing us out of $100 million in fraud, you know, basically gouging us, that'd be the end of it. You're done. No more for you. If it were you and me, that's what would happen. But since it's Oracle, they've got their tentacles all over the place. Lots of money to be had there. So we got $200 million back. I wonder how much we actually did lose. Anyway, have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads
kids need a home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhike.